Welcome to Roguecast, the official podcast of Rogues Gallery. We'll talk comics for the week, as well as whatever news is on our pop cultural radar. I'm Randy.
I'm Nick.
This is Dave.
And now, on with the show.
Episode 423 of the Roguecast, recorded July 11, 2023. You've got some big elf boots to fill, kid.
Hey, y'all. We're coming to you from our swampy store.
You know what? You say that, but it's actually not bad right now.
It's not bad, actually. We had, if you didn't see our Facebook, we had a little leak from our bathroom.
And a swamp formed.
And a lagoon formed in the back quarter of the store.
Yes.
It's not our first rodeo with this, or right. our first aquatic rodeo, if you will.
If you've been listening for any length of time, we've probably had approximately 3 to 4 flooding incidents, including we used to CC's because of how they like power wash the floor or whatever, would routinely leak into our store.
It would flood us routinely. Now we're on the other side of CC's, we don't get that as much.
But the epic adventure, the one that about against which all others will be measured, and part of the reason why this stuff that we had yesterday is not too bad, was the one that happened on Black Friday. It was when we were kind of making a comeback from the pandemic, and we're like, oh boy, thank God, it's the day after Thanksgiving, we're going to make some sales, and maybe we'll just survive this pandemic. And then we walk in, and there's 2 inches of water everywhere.
Yeah.
And so that was just the worst, the absolute worst. We still made it through it, and thanks again, that's still for everybody for helping us out that day. Yes, this was comparatively like a quarter of that.
So we're in our nice, quiet office.
Yes.
But outside,
there's fans running those giant industrial fans that dry the floors, which incidentally, they're doing a very good job of it. And they acted quickly.
Fans and they dry the floors.
Yes. Anyway, but we apologize for the inconvenience, because when you walk in right now, you're going to hear for a bit, and thankfully it's at least just kind of background noisy.
Yeah.
And there's some cords on the floor. Otherwise, the store, everything's shoppable. It's all out there.
Sure.
But yeah, we apologize for the mess. We didn't do it intentionally.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did. I just like,
you
turned on,
son of a
turned
bitch.
On the water to see what happened. My fault.
Oh, fucking Loki.
I wanted to make a like the Typhoon Texas thing. Those guys seem to do pretty well. I thought maybe we could be like a comics, games, and water park thing.
Sure. You're like, you don't need Kalahari.
Yeah. Yeah, Kalahari.
We got Kalahari
successful.
Right here.
So I thought, yeah, why not have like a pool in the corner of the store? It's not a great idea. My bad.
Well, you tried it.
Yeah.
You made an assessment.
Yeah.
You decided it's not our thing.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
That's a scientific method.
I'm going to murder Randy later.
I support it.
All right. Summer reading challenge is still going on. We got another, about another month. It's going to get through mid-August.
It is very much going on.
Yep. In fact, there's still spots for the first 2 super kids to return and get an Owlbear coin.
Yes.
Owlbear coins, which is essentially
a $10 gift certificate to the store. Get you something cool with it. But there will be gift packs for all.
Everybody gets cool gift packs. Yep.
And, you know, kids are having, like, a lot of fun with this.
I know Serena's enjoying reading all the reports that come back in, and people talk about their favorite part of the books.
Absolutely.
Yep.
And it's very adorable.
Yep.
It's also, even just like when the kids pick up the packets, they're hyped. It's nice to see kids hyped for reading.
Yep.
You know, I know that it has never gone away, but I think what Serena's cleverness is catching on to this was she was remembering when she was a kid, and like Pizza Hut and places like that would sometimes do these summer reading incentives, and you know, kids who were already kind of inclined to read would double down on it, and kids who might not be inclined to read would be like, I would like a free pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And then like it's a win-win.
Yeah. We have our board game day coming up on Saturday. Just a reminder, I'll put a reminder post on Facebook as well, but we have a few spots left open for most of the games. I think Flamecraft is closed, but most of the games have at least a chair or two available still. So
this is basically a demo day.
Yep, come in, try out some games.
How many total games?
8 total games,
right. And I think it's still key to mention that I don't know if we have a listings of how many of which ones are open or whatever, other than Flamecraft, probably not, but we want you to come out for this one because it will inform how much we do it in the future.
It's true. If nobody comes out for this, we'll be like, nope, nobody wants board games.
Then we will take naps.
Yep, we'll take naps.
And believe me, we'll take naps. We'll enjoy it.
We love a good nap.
But we would actually rather do game stuff and be interacting with y'all in the community and showing you some cool games.
I really like naps.
Okay, Nick is a nap guy.
Yeah.
We know where Nick is. Nick, Nip? Nip. I know where Nick is on this.
I'm kind of with Nick on this. I feel like maybe, you know, it's naps are great.
All right, now this is the time to remind our listeners that none of us slept well last night. And I think the flood affected every single one of us yesterday, and it involved lots of extra work, sometimes in the scorching heat. There was, like, lots of running in and out of the store. Yep. We had to have the door open a long time yesterday, and it got a little warm in the store. You know, that part is also done with.
Yep.
I feel like we crossed the worst part. But, yes, that's why Randy is attempting to promote naps over the very event he is hosting. You're not going to get a nap that day, Randy.
No, it's true. It's fair.
You got to show up one way or another.
We got a new game called 13 Words that is a party game from Asmodee that... basically, it's a co-op party game, and you have a captain who picks a word, and then you have to sort of, like, all guess. You have to find the links, find the meaning, and create links between the words, and you win points together if you choose the same word. So basically, you're trying to improve your score as a group. That sounds cool. Like in the same vein of, you know, Just One and some of those.
Yeah, that sounds cool. I like that.
My word
is grackle.
They have good party games. Well, now you've ruined the game.
I thought it was Hodag.
People don't know what hodags are, Nick.
You don't know that. They're
I know.
Russell knows what a hodag is.
No, he does not. He does not, I guarantee you.
Russell, you're being called out.
We got one of the new exit in the exit series of games, the escape room ones, called Disappearance of Sherlock Holmes. So
okay.
It's a Sherlock Holmes themed escape room game.
Right, so that seems very fitting. The rise of the escape room games has been a fun thing.
Yeah.
There's like... I think 3 to 4-ish type competitors. It's just a different kind of experience. It's, you know, it's a little get-together, generally cooperative kind of experience. And you play it in like an hour or two. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you either escape the escape room or you die in the game and die in real life.
Except for that last part, that's all correct.
Yes.
How do you know? Have you tried?
I have played
these. We've lost a few too many of them. Yeah. You know, it's the same as like kind of like real escape room things. You're like, I'm pretty smart, but like sometimes not that smart.
Are you sure you haven't been resurrected? You don't.
I mean, I do feel tired. Is that a symptom of resurrection?
He's making a case. We got
one of the symptoms.
A reprint of a new board game, or an older board game called Robo Rally, which I don't know if y'all ever played this.
No, never did, but I've heard.
It's been around forever. Sort of set up a little sort of algorithm for how your robot moves around.
Yeah, you're sort of like setting moves, and then you set them go, and they like bounce off.
Hasn't this been around since like the 80s?
It's an older game. Yeah, it's a classic.
The idea sounded neat to me. I like, even though my brain doesn't, I think, particularly work with the 12 steps ahead kind of chess-like thoughts and stuff. The idea of like sort of programming robot moves and stuff like that does sound fun.
Yeah, it's a fun game. We got the expansions for the Star Wars Shatterpoint, the sort of like squad based miniatures game.
Yeah, there's a Obi-Wan and Darth Vader. Mm-hmm.
It's based from the Obi-Wan TV show, his rematch with Vader.
Yes. There's also like the Inquisitors
pack,
Rebels.
And then there's a isn't it Luminar and Dooley
two clone troopers. Who?
Commanders.
You would know her to see her, but you won't know because they recognize her name.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't know her name. When Nick said her name, I'm like, yeah, that sounds right.
Is that the one who's Padawan? Yeah, traveled with Ahsoka a little bit in early Clone Wars
and screwed her over.
Were they both evil, or just the Padawan?
No, just the Padawan. Mm. She became disillusioned with the Jedi and framed her for murder.
I mean, that's fair.
Yeah.
They're not great. And then we got a game from Kickstarter from the same people that made a game called Cultivate, where you play competing cults.
Yep, sure.
Called Channel One. This one you are completing news programs, and you're trying to get the best
Anchorman fight.
Anchorman fight. Yes. It looks like fun. It's a smaller game than Cultivate. It looks like maybe a quicker game.
Where'd you get that trident, Randy?
He killed a guy.
I think you need to get out of town.
All right, let's talk comics for July 12th. Let's start with, as will be the case for the next 3, 4, or 5 weeks, Night Terrors.
Yeah.
Right, this is... We talked about it last week. Last week was kind of what it would be like the alpha special and right. the first batch of them. This week, there's like another Night Terrors number one, which might seem a little confusing.
This is the main series.
But it's the main series. Yep. It's going to be like a four issue thing.
Yep.
And then, you know, they'll continue to be like basically all the DC heroes, you know, getting their two shots, I think,
yep.
usually.
Yep. Two issues.
The first issue of the main series is a focus on Deadman.
Right, right.
And kind of...
People like Deadman, right?
I think so. People like Boston
Brand.
Oh,
yeah? Then why is he dead?
That's just his thing.
Because an assassin shot him.
That yeah. assassin didn't like him.
That's not every single person on the world, Randy. I was talking about every single other person on the world.
Everybody but that assassin likes him.
Everybody but that assassin.
Technically, the assassin might have liked him. He's just completing
He's just doing his job.
He's
crying while he takes aim for his scope. I mean, he's like, man, Boston Brand's the best.
Sorry, bro. he is one of these characters that is like a perpetual cult character, but if you like Vertigo and stuff like that, you know, if you have a foot in like DC's magic universes with Constantine and the Demon and stuff like that,
yeah,
chances are you are probably a fan of Deadman, who is a guy who was, yes, a circus acrobat who was killed by an assassin and resurrected by a vaguely Eastern goddess.
Yep.
Kind of.
Referred to as God.
Yep, and who sent him back kind of on a karmic-type journey, because he'd been a jerk in life, and that was kind of his character arc, was to become a better person and achieve some sort of nirvana.
So everyone didn't like him.
Yeah, okay, right. All right, whatever. You're still doing this bit?
Yes, I'm going to run with it.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, I guess the message is if you die as a jerky acrobat, you have to live as a ghost forever.
But he becomes a ghost hero,
yes.
And he can take over people's bodies and solve mysteries and stuff by, you know, jumping into whoever he needs to. This would be very much the kind of thing you'd see on, like, it feels like a TV show could take the basics of this just spin it.
Yeah.
He has taken over Batman, and Batman never likes it. Batman is cranky pants about it. He likes his bodily autonomy.
I think he likes to be in control. Batman. He might be a control freak.
Yes. You know, it's not like Deadman took over and like started playing with his nipples or something like that.
would have been weird.
That would have been weird. But what if he
it would have been a George Clooney joke, or, you know, or Val Kilmer. I forget which one happened. Was it Val Kilmer?
I believe they were in both the Val Kilmer one, but much more pronounced.
But
in Clooney Town,
it would have been amazing if Deadman. That's what he does. He takes him over. He starts rubbing his nipples, and then that's where Superman's like, "Boston, is that you?" And that's how he recognizes. Like, Batman never plays with his nipples, but Boston does it all the time.
That's how Deadman shows us who he's taken over.
We've gotten to a weird area here.
Yeah, this is.
You know, I was ready to move on, but you sleepyheads. Anyway, Deadman though is a cool character, and he is like. You know, he had a, Neil Adams drew his comic in the 70s.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons.
He was famously one of Neil Adams.
Why I was sort of beloved. But I first kind of knew him through his appearances in Books of Magic.
Yeah.
Neil Gaiman's cool exploration of DC's side world of magic. Obviously a much more kind of dark and serious thing. But Deadman was kind of fun because he's kind of like, he's talked a little like The Thing.
Yeah.
He was kind of a regular guy. And, just trying to protect Tim Hunter, the future possibly greatest magic user, from being killed by a zillion cultists.
Yeah.
Anyway, in this, he is our narrator. Does he do that thing where he, like, talks to the audience, right, Nick? I feel like there's that opening thing that's a little bit like, almost like a stylized thing, like a ringmaster.
Yeah, I mean, he's giving kind of a rundown of his character and who he is, and...
But that's just, I guess, for the opening.
Yeah. I mean, then he narrates, but he also is coming up against the main protagonist in the...
Or main antagonist.
Or antagonist in this book.
Insomnia.
I'm gonna
say his name. Yeah.
And kind of get a few revelations about that character, of where he came from.
Yes, there's a big thing about him that they don't reveal it yet, do they?
They tease it.
He's protecting some big secret, and that's clearly going to be kind of one of the arcs of this, you know, the reveals of the story to be had. I forget what ultimately gets set up with it. Obviously we don't want to tell everybody.
Yeah, Deadman gets some reinforcements.
Right, right. And he is like possessing Batman much of this time.
Yes.
Yeah. So he can do like the kung fu. He knows how to fight anyway. But I guess when you're in Batman, do you get the kung fu skills too?
I don't know.
Remarks that he's like, man, he's like, this is the most fit person I've ever possessed. I'd better play with the nipples immediately.
This time it was your fault.
However, I will say, I thought it was a good first issue. I'm liking that story.
And what other ones do we get this week as far as individual characters?
Robin. Yep. So Tim Drake. It's like a 2-in-1 with Tim Drake and Jason Todd.
And you know, these stories are generally about like things having to do with the characters' fears and anxieties and stuff. So I don't know. I haven't read the Robin one, but I'm going to assume that it goes back to those little elf boots that Robin wore back in the
day. No, this is a different one.
No, but I bet he was secretly fearful. What if he ever had to go back? Was forced to wear the original Robin's elf boots.
That is not what happened.
Some big elf boots.
If you know Tim Drake's history, you can guess what his major fear is.
Tim Drake. Let's see. His major fear is spoiler won't go on a date with him. His major fear is
the voodoo man who killed his parents.
It was not a voodoo man who killed his father. It was Captain Boomerang.
Captain Boomerang killed? Oh, God. That's not going back a ways. That's going back to Meltzer's terrible identity crisis story.
Yeah. Did they stick with that?
Yeah. And then Jason Todd.
Almost killed by a voodoo man.
Yeah. And then Jason Todd dealing with Joker.
But wait. Okay, once upon a time, every Robin, maybe until Damian had somebody, Two-Face had killed...
Two-Face killed Jason Todd's dad.
Jason Todd's dad. And I thought Tim Drake had somebody else who was, more known. That
Tim Drake's dad was alive for a while. His mom was killed.
That's
and
right.
And his dad was paralyzed.
He literally did get killed
and
in
his dad
identity
got killed
crisis.
by Captain Boomerang.
Yeah.
Which was dumb.
Yeah, it was dumb.
You remember that was kind of as portrayed at the time. That was over the hill, paunchy Captain Boomerang. He had a little bit of a beer gut going on.
Yep.
So Robin,
yep.
Zatanna.
Yep.
Which is I actually really liked that one. Was a team up with a member of the Doom Patrol.
Oh yeah, that's a fun idea. I like kind of linking up sort of two offbeat characters.
There's Green Lantern.
Right? Flash, I believe.
And Flash. I feel like there's... Oh, and Shazam.
Yep.
You know what Green Lantern's greatest fear should be? Is like a bad hair day.
He has no fear. It's his whole thing.
Oh, that's right.
It's true.
Bring it on. Bad head. Bring it on. I don't care.
That might be a thing that comes up.
We also... There is one... there's DC's World's Finest Teen Titans, which is a new miniseries... Spinning Out of the World's Finest, which is a sort of flashback miniseries that Mark Waid's been doing.
Right, which was a Batman Superman series.
Yes. This is the original Teen Titans. So it's like Robin and Aqualad and Wonder Girl, but it also includes Bumblebee.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And it is set in sort of the sliding timeline, so there's like drones and social media and all this stuff, but it is when they were younger kids.
Right. This is Robin when he looks like he could be, 12, 14, or maybe it's 14 or 16, something like that. But they're all younger. Mark Waid has gotten pretty good at this.
Yeah,
and
he's fun.
Once again paired with a good artist. They did, speaking of Robin, I love the original Robin outfit.
But they did
the sort of circus outfit. And this shows a little bit more of the influence of the very good 90s redesign.
But also, Dave, this
Tim Drake.
Remember that adult Robin had an adult Robin costume.
Right. There was, even in the, 1970s, they had an updated version. But I believe he had gross yellow tights.
He did.
And this, again, this took, more influence or some influence, I think, from the, Neil Adams speak. That's the thematic of the day. He did the redesign for Tim Drake in the 90s, which was a great redesign.
Yeah. So it's fun. The artist reminds me a lot of Cliff Chang.
Yes.
It's definitely worth a read.
Yeah.
Then we've got... What if they're doing what ifs again? They're all going to be
series
of one, and they're what if dark. Isn't that always what ifs thing? And what if always about how many people died?
Yeah, it's pretty rare that there was a what if, and they're somebody
better.
Else became Flash Thompson became Spider Man, and it would worked out.
It was great. It
never
was great.
What if Flash Thompson came became Spider Man? Aunt May died. Peter Parker was killed.
Right, yeah. No matter what happens, it always seems like it's bad. Maybe there's probably a few more things going on.
You know
what
would be messed up is if, in some messed up timeline, the burglar that killed Uncle Ben also on night one kills Spider-Man. He's like, I caught you, and he's like, no, you didn't.
I thought you were going to say he got bitten by a radioactive spider and turned into Spider-Burglar.
He was bitten by a radioactive gun. Turned into a giant, shiny gun.
Pete actually was
the ultimate NRA dream, by the way,
Pete
Randy.
He was bitten by a radioactive burglar and became Burglar Man.
He became Hamburglar.
So that's how Hamburger came to be.
I have the proportionate strength and speed of a burglar. Isn't that just regular? Yeah.
However, this is a...
I have a burglar sense.
So what's the title of this one?
This is What If Dark, number one, Loki. And this is a... It's written by Walt Simonson, one of the preeminent... Maybe the best Thor writer ever.
Right. Yep. He's, you know... It came up the other week, but he created... or he had the famous scene with the Executioner. He created Beta Ray Bill... he was the one who first, he was not the first person who did Ragnarok stuff. I know, Roy Thomas had done stuff like that in the 70s, but he kind of did it in the way that really got noticed.
So this goes back to Stan Lee and Jack Kirby's Thor number 153.
Right, he's actually calling back a story well before his own era in the 80s.
Loki was empowered by Carnilla the Nornquing to lift Mjolnir, and he steals it from Thor. And in this one...
He don't lose it.
He don't lose it. In fact, he kills Donald Blake... And then he kills Carnilla.
By the way,
then goes on a rampage.
For our younger readers, anyone under 30, 40, I don't know, Donald Blake was a human being who was a doctor who Thor used to turn into. Yep. He would strike his hammer on the ground, and he had a civilian identity. He literally... It wasn't like one of those things where it's like it was the same dude. He literally transformed into a human.
Then his hammer turned into a walking stick.
Yeah, because Don Blake had like a bad leg and had to lean on the stick all the time.
Yeah, this is one of those weird nihilistic ones where like Loki causes the end of everything.
Yep. Oh, nice. So it's a one shot.
It's a one shot. Scott Eaton does art. Eaton's a solid artist.
Yep.
He's not. It would have been better if Simonson had done it, but you know he's getting older.
Yep. Sure.
But yeah, so there's going to be a few of these. This is the first one.
Do you know, are they all character-based?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think...
But arguably, this is, even though it's not on the cover, this is story-based. If you were to do it in the tradition of the old What If titles, it would be what if Loki kept Thor's hammer when he got it back in 1969 or whatever?
I don't know if I'd specify all of that.
That's what I'm doing.
what if Loki had kept the hammer like he had in Thor number 153 when he was empowered by Carnilla, Queen of the Nords? Remember that, kids?
That's right. Smile and stand.
The next one, apparently, is What If Dark Spider-Gwen.
Oh, okay. What if Spider-Gwen had remained the Spider-Gwen?
What if her garage band had never been anything more than the garage band it actually is?
What if the Mary Janes never went big?
It cuts to them and they're all 35 or whatever, still playing in there, and they're like, we should probably learn to play instruments.
Do we want to talk about the other Marvel?
This is actually a really big thing to talk about.
Notably,
and better than we thought it was going to be. I know that there's a lot surrounding this comic, and it's, I think we're pretty sure the motivations behind it are rather cynical attempt to tie a Marvel comic into a movie.
The comic in question is Fallen Friend, The Death of Miss Marvel. This is, Miss Marvel died stupidly
in Amazing Spider-Man. Yeah.
Yes.
She had been a supporting character. And this is not a bad
idea.
Barely. But the idea that she was interning for Peter Parker's company or whatever, good idea. Yep. That's perfectly cool.
But
she died.
This is a character I really like. I hate that they did this. And yet, this one shot, it's three chapters. One written by her creator, G. Willow Wilson, with art by Takeshi Miyazawa, one of her early artists. In fact, no, Adrian Alfona was the creator.
Correct. Yeah.
Was he, right?
I believe he was the co-creator because he did all the original art.
And then a chapter by Mark Waid and Alberto Ramos, who famously wrote her in The Champions.
Yep.
And then a chapter called Avenger, which was written by her recent writer, Salah Nemed, with artists by Andrea DeVito. So it's a nod to her three big eras. And it is
There's some good writing in there.
The character, all her supporting cast is in. And it's written really well, and it is a love letter to how good this character is and how dumb it would be to kill her.
I'm not going to say... the G. Will Wilson section is the best.
It is. I mean, it's her character.
I actually really liked the final chapter by Saladin, whatever his name.
Saladin Ahmed,
Ahmed. I thought it ended on just the right note. It is, by the way, this is an interesting format. It's, told, are they actually at a mosque?
Yes.
And they're going through...
Kamala's.
What's that?
At Kamala's.
Her mosque.
Yes.
Her mosque. Yeah. Essentially a ceremony for... I forget, it's not exactly quite for the dead.
No, it actually, they make a point of that, because
Someone says she could still be alive, or she could come back to life.
Well, there's some interesting stuff, too, because there was some kind of disaster, and people who don't know that Kamala Khan was Miss Marvel, they know that Kamala Khan disappeared, or they know Miss Marvel disappeared,
right,
but they don't know for sure that she's gone.
It's a particular ceremony called
Khatam.
Khatam. That's my
friend
said.
All our brothers and sisters who were lost in that terrible day are still missing. Whether they are alive or not, these blessings will reach them.
Yeah.
Right, because somebody was like, hey, you know, she might not be dead. And indeed, we are really, I'd say, 100% certain that they are did not kill off this character permanently.
They're going to bring her back in weeks. I mean, she's already on the cover of a few books we've seen.
She is likely to be resurrected by the X-Men resurrection tech stuff from Krakoa. And and through whatever, some quirky sci-fi means, she's going to end up with some mutant genetics so that she can be a mutant, like she will be in the movies.
Right.
But
also, there's a QR code at the very end of this book.
Yep.
And if you click it now, it says, not today, but soon.
Right. There is something that will be revealed, probably, I bet, before the week is out.
Yeah.
Anyway, so here's the thing. Everybody knows it's kind of dumb that they killed her off, and it happened in a very out of... I mean, nobody was even paying attention to the storyline because it was a Spider-Man storyline that was burning out everybody.
Yep.
Surprisingly, and maybe not because the writers involved are good and close to the character, they actually ended up producing a good book, which I think we would all recommend.
Yeah.
Honestly, even if you bought it standalone and you know, just kind of put out of your mind that it came out of something lame,
yeah,
it's pretty good as a standalone.
Yeah, agreed. I agree. There's one of these flashback miniseries they've been doing bits and pieces of called X-Men Days of Future Past Doomsday. It is written by Mark Guggenheim, who has written... He wrote X-Men Gold and some other...
Mm-hmm.
It's not by Claremont, which would be the thing that makes most sense. But this is basically the story of how the Days of Future Past got to everybody living in camps and... Wolverine and Kitty being the last like survivors of it and all
that. You know, I guess I thought that it was a new approach to it. This is simply expanding on the classic Days of Future Past story.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, I gotcha. You know, that story is... For a story that was originally just a two-part story, you know, back in the day, although there weren't a ton of two-parters in the early 80s.
It's definitely made an impact
It made more of an impact than almost anything else.
Yeah.
And it has a kind of a neat origin. I know that Chris Claremont, the writer for a couple decades of really great X-Men stories, basically had said to the artist, John Byrne at the time, the Sentinels were lame, I don't want to do any stories with the Sentinels, they suck, they're boring. And Byrne was like, I could come up with a good Sentinel story. And that's the story he came up with, which is basically a couple years before the movie The Terminator has a lot of elements of The Terminator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sentinels rise up, exterminate, or put in work camps almost all the mutants. But I believe the whole, like, it's not one of those things where it's like, oh, the kind of xenophobes win. It's not like there's, like, gleaming cities and, like, ghettos for mutants. It's like the whole world kind of got heft over.
Sentinels basically decide that the humans are wrong. And that they need to take over everything. So
this is a very Terminator.
And there's some stuff in here. There's a bit where this council of like these shadowy guys, including like one of the Trask guys, and Kingpin, are talking about. They're like, he's like, are you saying the Sentinels might take over? He's like, I'm saying they already have.
Interesting.
And so they're definitely going into like the guys who tried to arrange, who were trying to use the anti-mutant sentiment for their own purposes, and sort of what happens.
So when I make a sign for this, which I haven't forgot to make one for this, I need to say an expanded version of the famous story of the rise of the Sentinels in Days of Future Past.
Yep.
Right on.
Yeah. Yeah. So
you said it's pretty dark.
It's really dark. You're going to watch a lot of X-Men die. in pretty awful ways.
But if you're a person who frequently rereads Deadpool Kills the Marvel Universe or something like that, then you might just have found your comic.
Why is my favorite one the first to go?
He's the most expendable.
He is not the
All
most
expendable. All he does is sing la-la-la-la-la-la-la-la sounds.
And it's true. He shrieks and flies. That's all he does.
He's a detective.
There's also Moon Knight 25 comes out this week. This is... Jed McKay's book.
Giant
is
issue.
It's a big, giant issue.
It's like what they call square bound. It's got not just a sort of spine, it's got a real spine, almost like it's a little graphic novel.
Yeah,
I thought it was called prestige format.
That's got more solid covers.
Really?
Yeah.
Usually, I've never heard square bound. Then it's square bound, right, Randy?
Yeah.
Yeah. But it may be one of those things where, like, all square bounds are prestige format and all prestige format are square bounds or something. I don't know. Anyway,
this is the story of Mark Moon Knight going up against one of his big foes.
What's his cool name?
Black Spectre.
Black Spectre.
And then there's also a C-list villain who appears in it and a flashback to his time as a mercenary, which reintroduced the first time we've seen him in this book. We see Frenchie. And we see Layla from the TV show. Yep. This is her first in-canon appearance.
That's interesting, because I thought it was quite seamlessly done, and I just assumed that she had been done in previous ones. You know, I know you follow Jed McKay's Moon Knight. I read Scattershot issues, but I really like it to the point where I've decided I'm probably just going to go ahead and start picking up the trade paperbacks of them.
Yep.
It's kind of deep enough into the series now at, 25 issues?
Yep.
That I'm like, okay, he is not about to fumble this ball.
Nope.
Honestly, even if for some reason I didn't like some direction, I would have some confidence that he would execute it pretty well. And I really like, we were just talking about this off mic earlier, how his Moon Knight is not quite the full batshit crazy person that somewhat Warren Ellis did at times, but more Charlie Houston's run where Moon Knight actually cut off the face of Bushman.
Yep.
And I was like, I don't want him to be a serial killer hero.
Dan,
you know?
I just want to say, it's Bushman, not Bushman.
Bushman.
Bushman is a different guy.
I was thinking
Plant
of... anyway, but he has an edge to him. Like, he is a dangerous character.
Yeah.
There's villains who are scared of him, and because when he gets kind of violent, he is more violent than other heroes tend to be. But he is also a pretty heroic dude, as you learn to know him in the show, in the series.
Yep.
It's had pretty consistently very good art.
The cover by McNiven is really good.
Yeah, there's a lot of good covers. As the anniversary, even Frank Miller, who's been doing some...
Not great covers
for Marvel as he's just doing a bunch of guest shots. Even his Moon Knight was pretty good. It was kind of Sin City Moon Knight.
Has this artist been on it the whole time?
Most of it. At least that I know of, Randy, right?
Yeah.
And you know what I like is that they use all of Moon Knight's weird foes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But they're really not they're really not treated as jokes or anything, even though these are essentially cult villains. And in fact, there's this sort of a notable development with one of the weirder villains in this one where I'm like, I will be interested to see where this goes.
Yep. We have a new book from IDW called The Hunger and the Dusk. It's written by G. Will Wilson, the co-creator of Ms. Marvel. Art by Chris Wildgoose. Great name.
Yeah, it is. It's
a cool name.
I wonder if that's Native American or something.
It's a very pretty piece. But basically, this is a fantasy story about what seems to be sort of maybe a vampiric threat that is uniting orcs and humans who have been at war.
Yep. Yeah.
And the central characters seem to be sort of this mercenary guy who maybe he's in charge of a lackluster mercenary company who is hired to bodyguard this young orc girl who I think is a sorcerer and a...
healer.
She's a healer, that's right.
Yep.
She's a talented healer, and she's their diplomat. And so the two of them are basically going to be... It seems like maybe there is a romance in the offing between them. I've heard it compared. They compared their Saga. It's a good first issue.
It is a different vibe than Saga.
Yeah.
Saga was definitely...
Saga's more irreverent.
It's more irreverent, and it's also... But, when it is serious, it's darker and more R-rated. This, I didn't catch too much R-ratedness when I skimmed through it.
Just some violence.
But it's sort of fantasy violence. This is Lord of the Rings-ish. I think, Nick, you said you were enjoying it, and, you were in kind of a fantasy mood, and that was part of...
I thought the world building was interesting. Mm-hmm. Their take on orcs, and their take on humans, too, was really interesting, and their differences, but the sort of coming together to defeat a common enemy mm-hmm. that could destroy both of them. I mean, it's a tried-and-true story.
But it sounds like, the romantic element and some of the other stuff might be taking it in different directions than you usually see.
Agreed.
As opposed to just the two bros who are in another world we could have been friends, now let's make a last stand together. That's been done a million times.
Yes.
But this is going to, I think, play out a little differently.
I also think the art is quite good.
The art's really good.
Really good, yeah.
It reminds me somewhat of somebody Carlos Pacheco when he was doing Aerosmith with Busiek. And,
right.
There's a lot of other artists. It's sort of a little bit of the European art, detailed art when they do fantasy stuff. But,
If you like fantasy at all, I
almost
think this
yeah,
is
almost certain
to try out.
The Hunger and the Dusk.
IDW also has The Rocketeer in the Den of Thieves coming out this week. So
it's a mini series,
either a mini series or one shot. I'm not sure which.
I think it's a little mini.
Is a little mini thing. And then Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles: Stranger Things.
I didn't know this. I had forgotten this was coming out.
It's kind of a clever idea because.
Yeah.
So the original Turtles were created in around 1985,
uh-huh.
and basically right when Stranger Things was set,
yep.
and this fully embraces that history so that when the kids on it are on like a trip to New York.
A field trip to New York from Indiana.
Because this had to have been Stranger Things season 2, because Max is in
there. Yeah, Max is in there. It's season 2 or 3.
Yep. And they run into the Turtles, and it is the Turtles as depicted in 1985 when they still all had the bandana things
are all red.
Yep. But you can tell them apart by their demeanor and their weapons and stuff. But, yeah, it is meant to visually evoke that era.
I was really impressed with the kind of blending of the two stories or, yep. and worlds.
There's a great bit where, like, I think Mike asks, it's either Mike or Will, I think it's Mike who asks, or maybe it's even Dustin, asked Leo, and he's like, you guys don't play D&D? He's like, we've tried.
Yeah.
Love that idea. There's also there's a neat little bit where they reference Eleven's time in New York, because that was a thing in season 2. And they were,
right.
So,
and
because Mike, I think Mike asked her, he's like, how'd you know what bus to get here? And she's like, I've done it before.
Yep.
Yeah, that's clever. There's also, I don't want to give away too much, but there's some Hawkins weirdness, but as filtered perhaps through Baxter Stockman.
Yeah, man, that was such a good idea.
And that's neat.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fun. It's a lot of fun. This is one of those things, like, when we heard it announced, like, oh, that kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
I could say they could do it right.
They embraced it, and actually even more than I thought they would, the era.
And I like the stylized artwork.
Yeah, the art's
kind of, that fits both properties, but I think it really does the Turtles justice.
You know what's funny is that, you know, of course, the Turtles were literally created in 1985. Stranger Things is a nostalgia show set in 1985. Yeah. They're two different vibes, but, you know, they, you know, obviously the Stranger Things loves the era. So.
Yeah. We've got a new boom book called Sirens of the City that is about a young woman who is pregnant and wanting to get an abortion and has mind control powers.
That is an odd collection of events.
She's like a punk, and she's like living on the streets. Well, it is a strange...
She doesn't have mind control power so much as that she might be the titular siren.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
she tells Greek mythology?
Well, she is a siren.
She tells some pro-life protester, he like gets in front of her, and she's like, go jump in front of a bus, and he does.
Yep.
Yeah, it's very much like the voice of God stuff.
There's definitely sort of a fantasy... bent to this as well, because there's different kind of
stuff from mythology or something
and stuff.
I'm sort of surprised that Boom stepped into something that's a politically thorny issue.
I'm not.
I thought they were usually kind of slightly middle of the road.
Something's
not,
killing
not that
children,
like...
Dave. They kill children all the time.
It's true.
There's
a but there's some. This is a largely black and white gray tone book with some like. Purple, blue, and red highlights, and it's a really striking art style. But yeah, you'll see the cover of this, and you'll instantly know whether it's a book you want to read or not. But I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah.
Two new Image books. There's Antarctica Number 1, which is a sort of conspiracy book about a girl whose dad goes missing in an Antarctic science facility, and then she basically gets a job at that station and winds up finding out more about what's going on down there. So a little bit of that, you know, sci-fi conspiracy vibe. And then Fish Flies, the new, also square-bound from Jeff Lemire.
Yeah, this feels like it's a double-sized sort of first issue.
Yeah.
But because he actually draws this one, right?
Yep.
Somewhat rare for him.
He's writing and drawing this one.
But he always, one of the things I think he is absolutely great at is, like, letting his artwork and storytelling breathe.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And, So he uses the space well with his extra page count for it.
His use of a singular sound effect in here is
rather unnerving. This is kind of a gross comic.
Yeah.
It involves an actual phenomenon, but we're all at least somewhat familiar with, because if you've in Texas, if you've ever had the thing where suddenly crickets seem to swarm over places overnight.
Yeah.
This is the same kind of thing. The fish flies are just another term for something like that in Canada, where he grew up, which are these kind of like river and like lake bugs that come out really intensely for like a week or two, and then they just all die off in vast numbers, just like our crickets.
Well, in the backup, though, however, they have a smell that comes of it's like the actual fish smell.
Those are crickets. They have a nasty smell.
That's true.
Yeah, that's true. They do.
But this might be worse. But amidst this, there is, it kind of allows him to do both his kind of small-town weirdness, you know, some misfit kids. Think, like, I don't know, Stand By Me kids, but more like real kids.
Yeah.
Instead of being like, we're going to be buddies forever, they're like, hey, you're a pussy if you don't do blank.
Yeah. Right.
That's more like, yep, like your actual friends back in the day. And I say friends in quotes. but there is also a sort of weird murder mystery.
Yep.
There is some, what's it, Kafka's Metamorphosis,
yep,
weirdness going on, yep, here. It's typical, I say typical Jeff Lemire Strange, but its roots are very much normal people, not just kids, but also a few adults in a small town. And I always find his characters very readable. So I enjoyed this first issue.
I did too. My brain went for Stand By Me Meets the Fly.
Yeah, I like it. That can be our tagline.
Finally, I want to mention that there is a new trade that came out this week. It is Fantastic Four, Volume 1 by Ryan North. If you've been listening to this podcast, you know we all really enjoy this book. This is the first six issues.
There's six issues, okay. I was curious.
And
does it wrap with the Doctor Doom thing?
No, that's on the next issue.
Okay.
It wraps with... is it the first page?
Okay, so if that was the case...
No, it is six issues. Was that issue six that he was in? No,
I don't remember.
He was issue seven.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, these were a collection of... There was kind of a neat thing he did, which was pretty much all of these initial stories were standalone issues, but that did further a story arc, too.
Yeah.
And it culminated in what I thought was a really awesome team gathering together sort of thing again. He did not try and reinvent the wheel with the Fantastic Four as characters or anything. Like, remember, Randy, remember Grant Morrison's crazy Fantastic Four, 1, 2, 3, 4?
I do.
And I kind of like it, but man, that was like...
I do too, but it's weird.
It's weird. This is the FF you know and love. There's a sort of science, sci-fi plot, a lot of stories that, you know, I would say have elements of, like, Twilight Zone, Doctor Who, mm-hmm, anything where strange science fiction stuff shows up. And, you know, the characters kind of have to figure it out, including sometimes, like, early on they're not all together for reasons which come together, are revealed over time in a really cool way.
And revealed pretty quickly, yes, in all things. Yeah.
I remember, yeah, this was happening right as we were being very frustrated with, like, going on year two of that Spider-Man mystery dragging,
yes,
out.
Yep.
And issue here, 27.
He, this is like issue three.
In the first arc... resolved, like, the major mystery, did it in a satisfying way,
mm-hmm,
even though it kind of looked like it was going to be one of these things where they're like, oh, Reed screwed up so badly, he's kind of almost a villain. No, he's not.
Nope.
And he had a really good sense of the characters. So, yeah, this is a very recommended FF run.
Yeah, I think
us.
We all really, really like this, and we, yep, would highly recommend. Also, there's a cover gallery in the back.
Oh.
This had those Alex Ross covers.
Yeah.
So there's, like, it's got all the Alex Ross covers, it's got a J. Scott Campbell, it's got some Phil Noto, there's some, nice, really nice FF covers of Pete Promoco back in there.
Yeah, that's
some really nice covers in the back, too.
That is a good lineup.
Yeah.
It has the cover that has all the FF as cats.
It does have the cover that has all the FF as cats. which, by the vagaries of how reprints work, we actually had longer than any other cover.
Yep.
all right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about a whole bunch of trailers and a little bit of comic book and movie news. All right, so we watched, like, seven trailers this week. There's a lot of trailers.
We're barely alive.
It's true. We like some of them.
Yep.
Others, not so much.
Sure.
One, we hated. I don't know.
Let's run down the list.
Okay. All right. So, in no particular order, let's talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, which is the new Martin Scorsese.
It is.
And is based on a true story.
Based on a true story.
And
based
stars
on
Leo DiCaprio, as with all Martin Scorsese movies, are legally required to have Leo DiCaprio or Robert De Niro in them.
It's weird that they're, like, marketing as Leo as the lead, because Jesse Plemons is actually... his character is... I know. And he's actually the biggest part in the entire book.
And Jesse Plemons is, in my opinion, a better actor than Leo DiCaprio.
I agree.
I don't know if I... Leo is actually really good when
he's fine.
He's also super charismatic when he wants to be.
Sure, but Jesse Plemons is a better actor.
Yes.
Maybe.
All right,
you might say he's the poor man's Matt Damon, though.
I would definitely not say that. I would say Matt Damon is the poor man's Jesse Plemons.
I thought the idea was that Jesse Plemons was the poor man's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Well, that's possible.
But that's also some reductive horseshit, so
yes.
I think we can all agree Jesse Plemons is a great actor.
Yes, he is.
Anyway...
What, he is the poor man of Nowhen.
What year is this set? Is this in the Old West? Is it in the 1920s?
My brain says
I thought I saw a car. Are there cars and stuff?
There's cars in the Old West. Remember the one that Tom Sawyer drove in Lake of Extraordinary Gentlemen?
Uh-huh. Like a Batmobile kind of thing?
Yeah, like a Batmobile kind of thing. They were Batmobiles in the Old West.
1920s.
I got it right. Thanks, Randy.
So yeah, about the Osage Native American tribe.
I was
being pushed onto land that was believed to be just the most shittiest place to live.
But turned out to have oil.
Turned out to have oil, which they refer to as black gold.
Then the government took it back.
No.
Well, okay.
They get to keep their money in ways, but the white men definitely kind of sneak in and try to steal it from them.
It looks like there's almost pressure and violence and other things.
To the point where there is a slew of them being killed.
Okay.
And
that is definitely a thing that capitalism likes to do. Yep.
There's definitely more to it than that. It is, the book is in super readable. I mean, it's nonfiction, so it's sure. kind of, but it is very like crazy.
So let me ask you something in this, just from what I pieced together on the trailer. And, you know, Martin Scorsese, he's touched on a lot of things that have a foot in the historical stuff, or sometimes are kind of like more serious historical elements. But, Randy, you were just watching Gangs in New York for the first time, stuff like that. Yep. Anyway, so it looked to me like Leonardo DiCaprio's character is some kind of entrepreneurish type person who's sent to, I don't know, try and you know, maybe get this from them, but falls for a native woman? Or
incorrect.
Is he trying to manipulate her? Is it one of those things?
He's already married to one of them.
Okay.
And he is not a good guy.
Well, I didn't think he probably was.
I don't want to...
Yeah.
The story is really good. Just go in and expecting...
It might be a slightly heightened version of it, but this is all based in reality,
yes.
right?
Yes. It's all based on true story.
I've fallen off Scorsese a little bit in the last few years. Like, I didn't like The Irishman super a lot.
Yeah, I never tried.
But, and I tend to like his mob movies more than anything else. But this has my attention. I'm curious to see it.
Yeah, I don't like Scorsese. I think I've kind of come to that conclusion from...
You don't even like Goodfellas, which is his best movie.
I don't dislike it. I just am indifferent to it.
You don't love it the way that I love it.
Correct. Yeah. But that is sort of like, I don't care for mob movies.
Do you agree that Goodfellas is Scorsese's best movie?
The only challenger for me, certainly it's his most watchable movie, but the challenger would be Taxi Driver.
I figured, yeah.
Which is such a singularly focused movie, and I feel like every scene in it works, that it's hard for me to
And beat, I feel like based on
those are the two.
This trailer, it's definitely been...
I know some people, it's Raging Bull, by the way, but I was just never quite into that
Nixon
one.
Aviator Man.
I mean, I watched it.
You're
I watched
Wall Street
it.
Daddy.
Yeah, I am a Wolf of Wall Street Daddy. Nobody's an Aviator Man.
No. Although that has
it's got
Galadriel.
Who's playing? Is it Cate Blanchett?
Yeah, it's Cate Blanchett.
She's great in that.
She's great in that.
You know what nearly broke me? In college, I went and saw The Age of Innocence with Michelle Pfeiffer.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Somebody in it. And it was one of those period pieces that's where people have restrained dinners. It's not even like Downton Abbey or whatever where things get like fiery.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, he said so much with just the lift of an eyebrow that the entire family was scandalized.
And you're like, did he? Because I didn't catch him.
I'm like, this is difficult.
So I have to say, there are three movies that he made that stand out for me.
Okay.
Weirdly, I like The Color of Money.
Never seen Color of Money.
Paul Newman and Tom Cruise.
One of them, the remake of Cape Fear.
No, it actually is not. I weirdly like his animated film, Hugo, quite a bit.
Hugo's pretty good.
Is that animated?
Yeah.
Oh.
Or was it animated?
No, it wasn't animated.
Okay, no. Maybe part of it was or something?
I feel like part of it was, or it was like...
They're live-action children.
Hugo's actually really good.
Hugo is very good. And it's been years since I've watched it. But After Hours, I remember really enjoying.
I forgot that was him. After Hours, a ton of fun.
Griffin's done. After Hours,
right? Griffin Dunn. Right?
Yeah, I believe that is correct. Yeah.
What's that about?
Griffin Dunn, Rosanna Arquette.
She's a prostitute, and he's a yuppie, and they wind up on the run in the streets of New York, or something.
Yeah, it is one of those weird things that I think was at the beginning of his career. I think it was in 85. Yeah. But it's really really fun.
Okay. All right. So we'll allow that you've made some decent movies, Scorsese.
Yeah, I guess.
This trailer looks very Scorsese.
It looks pretty good.
But yeah, it looks good.
I think it's an interesting piece. I like him stepping away, honestly, from like kind of mob stuff.
Yeah.
And
it's no Iron Man 2.
It's definitely Iron Man 2.
I expect really good things. This the cast.
I'm expecting at least pretty good stuff from.
Yeah. I am expecting to enjoy it when I watch it at home because it's going to be like 3.5 hours long.
Well, it's also going to be on Apple TV. So,
is it? It's only in theaters.
I know, but it's coming to theaters first, but it's going to Apple because they made it.
Good. Yes. We saw the trailer for The Creator. This is by Gareth Edwards, who I think Dave, you and I have disdain for.
Yes, somewhat. He's a guy who started out with kind of a breakout indie sort of monster movie called Monsters.
Yeah.
Monsters that was, at least in theory, I kind of liked the idea, was that in a future where, let's just say that people who are afraid of people south of the border kind of got their way and built a wall and stuff like that. This was, by the way, made pre-Trump.
Yeah.
That it turns out that when... some kind of giant kaiju rises up that, what is the deal? Oh, I think there's, like, some Americans that are visiting in South America or something like that, and they're kind of, like, trying to flee this thing and end up not being able to get into America because there's a wall there.
It's
funny. Anyway, it was a movie that got some buzz, and then I saw it, and I was like, it's okay. It's not quite as good as I had hoped. But solid, you know, first effort. Then his big thing was from that, I guess he got Rogue One.
Well, Godzilla.
That was for...
He did Godzilla before.
Right, that led to Godzilla, which I was not a big fan of. Nick, no. You liked more. Randy, you liked
it.
Okay.
I hated it on first watch. Yeah. I have subsequently gone back to it, and I've enjoyed it for what
it was. You had to get past
your
initial lizard hatred.
Well, I had to get my past my initial human hatred, because that was what that most movie was mostly of. Godzilla
right.
didn't
that
come
into, Brian
like...
Cranston and stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember liking it okay in the theater, and then I liked it less when I tried watching it again.
And I had the reverse. Yeah. I actually liked it better on subsequent watches.
It was one of those things where you're like, why'd they have Brian Cranston in this?
And I'm a famously grumpy about Rogue One.
Yep.
Extending
to
Andor.
To the fandom, it is the greatest Star Wars movie ever made because
true.
It's dark.
Yep. So I am very skeptical of this guy's movies. And Nick, you would say you're generally a fan.
I'm generally a fan.
I think you and I both thought this trailer for The Creator looked interesting.
It looks interesting. It definitely does seem to be rehashing some ideas that we've seen before.
You know, it reminds me of another genre guy, the guy who made Chappie Man.
Yeah, Chappie Man.
But what was his breakout?
District 9.
District 9 was a movie that kind of wore its heart on its sleeve about making an allegory about undocumented immigrants.
Yeah.
And doing it through literal aliens. This movie is about Scary Rise of AI.
Yep.
It's set in the future, like, what, 10 years after some AI thing set off a nuke?
Dropped a nuke on Los Angeles, yes.
Yep. And I will say this. It is a good time to demonize AI. I think we probably need to go ahead and get there.
Yep.
Everybody who's read Dune knows that Frank Herbert seems to have predicted this. There was the Butlerian Jihad, in which butlers were not involved. I've always been confused on this issue.
Oh.
But they did destroy all the AI, or thinking machines, as they called it, and that's why you have to have Mentats in the future, in Dune's future, because AI sucks.
You're saying that Alfred is not in Dune.
You know what? Do you think, like, before that, though, that, like, Paul Atreides would have been like, oh, did you see I can make myself look like an AI cowboy and AI vampire and stuff like that? Anyway, we're going astray, though.
This trailer looked, and this is a weird thing to say, it looked rich. Like, the world looked cool.
Yeah.
And it has a very interesting aesthetic.
But it also looks very gray and action, and I'm like... Is this going to be Zack Snyder action?
I mean, it is an action sci-fi movie, because the main dude is like a soldier or something
like
that.
He looks like a mercenary.
Who's
like,
the actor?
It's John David Washington, who was in Tenet, and...
right.
Which is famously exciting.
Was he also the actor in Black Klansman?
Yes, I think so.
He's like Denzel Washington's son.
Yeah, he's Denzel Washington's son.
Yeah.
He's
anyway,
great.
And he looks pretty good in it.
It also has, like, Gemma Chan, Ken Watanabe... Yeah. Benedict Wong.
But back to the plot for a second, because I'm just trying to piece it together. As you know, we watched this on Randy's laptop before we do this, and the sunlight always hits it at such an angle, and it's kind of got an old screen.
You can watch these trailers beforehand.
I'm not trying to throw your laptop under the bus. I'm just saying I can't see what's happening. anyway, I did watch this one a month ago when it first came out.
We were coming to this a little late because I was listening to a podcast and this was sort of like mentioned as something upcoming that they were excited for, and I was like, I missed this trailer.
I saw it for the first time last week.
So help me puzzle out the plot thing here. What is occurring in the present that, you know, brings it all into focus? There's
a robot child.
Robot child. It's some sort of next iteration of the AI, maybe.
Yeah.
And it seems like destroying it would be, for humans, a good victory, but it's kind of a creepy thing for him to contemplate because we don't know too much about his character, so we don't know why it's like, I guess the average person might be like, I don't want to shoot a kid.
Would they?
A robo kid is different, though.
Yeah.
No, but he seems like he may have possibly some empathy for this kid, and that may, you know, play, you know, this is going to be one of those things where his own troops and stuff may turn on him or something like that. He may become a marked man, go on the run. That's the pattern I'm guessing. That's the tropes I'm guessing.
That's what it looks like.
But like you said, it does look like a pretty rich world. It uses Aerosmith's Dream On and this kind of a haunting, slightly stylized version of it.
I like the look of their AI characters. Like, the robots all look different, but the AI with kind of like the hole through their head. And Ken Watanabe is an AI, I'm guessing samurai. Mm-hmm. It looks really neat. I don't know. Probably my favorite trailer we watched today.
Interesting.
I would say that the Scorsese one was probably my favorite of them, but it's a good trailer, kind of against my own... I've also kind of gotten a little tired of just action sci-fi stuff, sort of the notion that, like, you can't have, like, a sci-fi idea if there's not a bunch of people shooting each other over it.
But then again, if you have something sci-fi without a bunch of people shooting, you wind up with something really boring like Annihilation.
Hey, that's on the creators there.
You thought that was boring. I really enjoyed Annihilation.
Okay. I actually think Annihilation could have been good. And
I agree that it could have been good.
I liked parts of Annihilation. And then parts of it left me wishing to terminate myself.
Interesting.
I feel like I have actually seen some sort of more ambitious sci-fi in recent years, but I'm just going to blank on it right now. Yeah. I don't know, something like Moon, you know, that weird little indie thing with Sam Rockwell. It would be a good example of something.
And the evil Kevin Spacey.
But who's not evil in that?
I mean, the actor was. The actor was.
Yeah, that's true.
Alright, we got the trailer for the Nun 2, Nun Harder. And,
None at all. Master of None. We're having none of that. Right, so in the Conjuring movies, the Nun thing has shown up since, what, Conjuring 2?
Yeah, yes.
I believe. It's like one of their cases, right?
Yeah. And it kind of recurs throughout the second one. One of the scariest scenes I've ever seen in a movie, to be honest.
It's a great
the
scene.
The thing with the... Is it... I don't remember. Is it a woman who's alone in the...
Well, it's the
wife.
It's the wife, yeah.
Who's the... What's her name? It's the Blanks. They're family. They're the investigators.
The Hoodwinks.
They are the investigators of the supernatural that the Conjuring movies are about.
They are the Warrens.
Warrens.
Yes, she is alone in this room with these super creepy nun painting, and it's got that thing where it's like, oh, is it looking at her?
Well, it's like the shadow that's moving around the room and then stops at the painting.
Right, and as she approaches it, like you're like, is this painting about to come to life? And they stretch it out so that it's actually several minutes long, and it's a very unnerving sequence. But so unnerving, I guess, that they were like, let's start doing some movies that reveal the secret of this thing. So, is this the second Nun movie?
It is.
I think I saw the first one, and it was okay.
Yeah, I think that's where I fell down on it.
Which is, several of the Conjuring Expanded Universe movies are essentially okay. Really, the only the main Conjuring movies are generally pretty good.
And only the first two. The third one was bad.
How many have there been?
Three.
I thought, there's not a fourth one already?
No.
Of what, Conjuring?
Yeah.
No.
Was the third one the devil thing? The devil made me do it?
Yes.
Oh, so there is a third.
So there's three,
Annabelle comes home.
There's three Conjurings. There's two Annabelles.
And there's three Annabelles.
Three Annabelles,
because Annabelle's come home is like the one where it's the Warren's daughter at their house.
Okay. Right, but before that there was really Annabelle good. And Annabelle 2. Yeah, I actually like that one because it's a departure from the others and it's more of like a fun teen horror movie.
Yeah.
Anyway, these are hit-and-miss movies. I guess this trailer was okay.
Yeah. I wasn't blown away by it. It used the same sort of gag with the painting.
Right. There was other things like where the visual, like, you would see the shape of the nun's creepy image, like in a bunch of fluttering magazines on a newsstand where they would blow to just the right page to sort of make form the body and stuff.
Right,
I was just, like, that's pretty cool.
I've decided that Valak is a trickster. She likes to have fun. That's how she gets her kicks, by making her visage come out of random things.
Probably when she becomes a bi icon, just like Babadook.
They said in this trailer at some point they said it was a fallen angel.
Yeah.
I was trying to remember if angels are traditionally, biblically, always male, or if it's one of those things where it's, like, sort of genderless.
I think they're genderless, if I had to guess.
And if so, you know, like, yeah, I don't remember any of the backstory of the nun, like, why a demon or, like, a fallen angel would end up embodied as a spooky nun. The spooky nun must have been, like, a specific person, you know, from, like, 17th century
Prague. I think it would have to be
Prague.
Sort of, because it's blasphemous. I mean, that would make the most sense.
Sure. That's, I don't have any better explanation in this, so therefore that's the truth.
anyway, I don't know if I'm
gonna... This is probably a wait-on sort of thing.
This is a rental, not a run to the theater.
What was it? There's some horror movie that's doing good right now. Is it Insidious?
It's Insidious.
Or was there another one? Because, like,
Red Door, it kicked Indiana Jones to the curb this weekend.
Yes. And the funny thing is, the reason why these movies can kind of... Horror movies have... are always, I think, somewhat popular for studios is they generally are cheap and they can oftentimes make, like, easily, like, quintuple its budget.
In a weekend, it's already made its budget back.
Yeah.
That's what I heard. It's crazy.
Also, the horror genre is awesome.
It is. I agree.
So is that.
Except for the ones that are not.
Except for the ones that are not, which is a lot of them.
But you have to press play to find out.
Yep.
You don't have to.
No, I'm compelled.
Reminds me, did I ever talk about the boogeyman?
You did not.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if
I remember it enough now.
I'm waiting for that to hit VOD.
When you
whatever.
Do, let's discuss it for the purposes here. I found it a solidly watchable, if not very inspired, horror movie. But solid enough to say, if you like this kind of thing, you should probably see it.
What is our next trailer?
We got Napoleon. This is a biopic from...
historical
Ridley Scott.
Who loves biopics.
Yes, he does. He is the opposite of me in that way, and then I hate biopics.
I was,
he also likes fake biopics, like Gladiator, and, you know.
Yeah.
I was reminded of, like, his, I'm going to say, ill-chosen biopic of Columbus.
Yes, 1492, Conquest of the New World.
I never saw that one.
I saw this in the early 90s or whenever it came out. I think it was early 90s.
Yeah, it was.
And it was Gerard Depardieu as Columbus. And I think, you know, like, portrayed him as, like, a haunted man, man who maybe committed a few bad things, but did it for the right reasons or something, and that we were supposed to feel sorry for it. I'm like, as time has gone by, and we've found, like, Columbus's journals, and you can go in there and see him talk about essentially pimping out 10-year-old native girls to his men and how they're in demand.
He was terrible.
I'm like, this is a monster. Columbus needs to be burned in the trash heap of history. Mm-hmm. Yeah, talk about it for sure. But remember the part about the genocidal maniac.
Yep.
So, this leads us to wonder, though, like, Napoleon. I don't know a lot about him.
I don't either.
I know he is one of these figures that is kind of one of the great world conquerors, right?
Yeah.
And I say great in the sense of simply important.
Yeah.
You know, he is up there with Alexander the Great and Genghis Khan and all the other dudes. But I don't believe...
He was in prison on the Isle of...
Where is it?
I don't know.
But then he was, like rescued?
Like a plot in, like, The Man in the Iron Mask, though?
So here's the thing.
No, I think that was an actual thing.
He definitely was imprisoned on an island afterwards. He was exiled on the island of... God, I can't say it.
I don't know that much about Napoleon, and I don't know that I care to learn.
To me it looks, like, as a general thing, yes, it seems interesting, you know, that sort of, like... what makes a person, become driven to become that level of a conqueror? He was apparently, like, just one of the great tacticians, I think. I think that part is legit.
This is not just him as emperor, essentially. This is him, like, taking the crown. Becoming king.
Yep. Who's playing him? It's
Joaquin Phoenix.
He's probably going to do a great job.
He is. He's... He's always very good at what he does.
And he's a really good actor.
Yep. I hate him as Joker, but, you know, whatever.
Right. But I don't think you would say he gave a bad acting job.
So here's the thing about Ridley Scott. I want to say he's past his prime, but he's not, because he's made some really good movies
on
the last, like, 10 years.
Still makes really good movies.
I really enjoyed The Last Duel. I thought that was very good.
Oh, yeah. And I actually think, like, The Martian is, like, one of my favorite movies of, like, the last 10 years. I think it's great.
But, like...
Like a five-star movie.
Blade Runner 2049. I even like Kingdom of Heaven.
Like, Kingdom of Heaven is okay.
Yeah.
But it is actually a perfect example of kind of why I think he's kind of does some hokey historical rewriting. Because Kingdom of Heaven definitely was one of those where... I know it was kind of a post-9/11 world where he kind of wanted to present a kind of both sides-ism.
Yeah.
Like, there's honor and villainy on both sides. And I think he portrayed a kind of a cheesy fable out of it. But that was so well acted and stuff that, you know, on the surface it is pretty well made.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of appreciate, I forget the name, it's like, who's the famous Middle Eastern, like, where is it, like, Saladin or something like that?
Oh, I think
he's kind of, like, very honorable, but also, like, you know, a ruthless warrior. But like, I think he was fascinatingly portrayed and all of that stuff.
Yeah, it is Saladin.
And it's just one of those, but I'm like... This seems wildly ahistorical. I don't even know a ton about it, but I'm like, it felt wildly ahistorical.
Yes.
Napoleon is probably going to be more there, but yeah, I'm like, I kind of, from what I think I know about Napoleon, he is also like kind of a war criminally,
yeah,
you know, ultimate short man syndrome dude. But like, was he also honorable? I don't know. I don't know if he was a good person who lost his way, or a wildly narcissistic egomaniac in a cautionary
Island
tale.
Of Saint Helena was where he was exiled to.
I feel like there's another name that I've heard. Yeah, no, there is another name.
Island of the Dolls.
Oh, no. Exiled to the Island of Elba.
That's it.
That's it.
I knew it was E something, yeah. Anyway, this is. I'm probably not going to see this in the theater, but I might watch it if it gets some decent reviews. If people react like they do to, like, because he does make some kind of stinkers, including like Prometheus and stuff.
Yeah, so I do want to watch this because I do want to learn. He was actually exiled to two islands.
Yeah.
How do they just not kill him?
There is a famous Greek general who like changed sides like three times over the course of like 10 or 20 years of campaigns.
Yeah.
And was every time he did it, like, he was still beloved by the people. They're like, well, I understand why you did it. And I feel like it was even like one of those people, like, whatever side he turned against, they're like, we understand why you left us.
Like,
it's okay.
I feel like the Dollop would have made a good podcast about Napoleon.
I have to look and see if they've done one. That would actually be very fun. I can almost already imagine them, because I bet he was like one of these little insane prodigies where it's like, at age 13, he led the battle of blah, blah, blah. And I can sort of picture them. They do some of their best work when they're joking. This is a podcast, y'all.
Yes.
If you haven't watched it, listen to the Dollop. When he's imagining, like, little kids who grew up too fast.
Yeah.
And we're like little adults at age 10 or 12. I believe the Benedict Arnold one.
The Benedict Arnold
one. Truly spectacular.
Was great.
I was dying laughing at the opening.
That one was great.
Anyway, so we're mixed on this, but I think Nick and I have an interest.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm curious where we landed on this one. The Wonka trailer. This is Timothée Chalamet playing a young Willy Wonka. Famously, Tim Burton made one with Johnny Depp that is not good.
No, right? It's awful.
And I feel like the lesson I took from this was, don't remake a movie that's pretty much perfect for what it is.
Yep.
And which happened by accident. Like, that movie almost didn't happen.
Yeah. Oh, is that one? Have you watched one of those behind the scenes things?
I listened to a podcast on it.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And like, it is one of those things. Like, they didn't want Gene Wilder. Gene Wilder improved a bunch of the stuff. Like, there's almost no way that movie happens the way it did.
You know, I'll say this. I've read the books and stuff.
Yeah, they're okay.
Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator.
Yep.
And I liked them a lot. I've read James and Giant Peach and all the other stuff by Roald Dahl. Only to later find out, wild anti-Semite.
Yeah, I haven't gone back to them because I'm afraid to find out what's in there.
Mostly they were just kind of like, they were kind of mean-spirited, but kind of in a way that was generally sort of darkly fun.
Yeah.
And like, I think he tended to do, he roasted kind of like evil aunties and stuff in, James and the Giant Peach. And what he saw as like, I guess, the next generation of slobby kids in Willy Wonka.
Yeah.
But the movie did sort of take, I think, I believe Willy Wonka in the books was kind of like a little old man.
Mm-hmm.
And so Gene Wilder, not a little old man.
Yeah, Roald Dahl hated the casting.
Yeah, and yet he made that role his own, like, in almost the way you only, you know those people who back in the day who could like sing and dance and act and all that stuff?
Yeah.
And he's one of those guys?
Yeah.
You almost had to be one of those people like I think he was. Steve Martin's another person like that.
Willy Wonka is an iconic movie.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just
so. I don't think this is a good idea.
I don't either. To me,
I would say though, this is not a remake.
No,
right? This is him and his sort of upcoming
this is the origin
days.
Story.
But I don't think that's a good idea either.
I don't necessarily.
It's
think
him versus the chocolate cartels, I believe.
The chocolate cartels did make me laugh out loud. But here's the thing: if it was laughing at chocolate cartels as hard as we were.
Yes.
I think I'd be more interested. But it seems to be taking itself a little quirky seriously.
I believe, yeah, he's like, I am an imagineer of chocolatier.
Y'all know that the Wonka movie happened because of the candy, right?
Is that like what they were pushing? Just trying
they
to
were,
sell
They were
candy?
Making a movie to sell candy. It was funded by the Willy Wonka Chocolate Company, basically.
Yeah.
Because they were trying to sell their Wonka bars, which apparently were crappy chocolate.
That sounds right.
I think I'm on board this one because I like the director.
Who's
and
the
he,
director?
He did Paddington, which
right,
is
right.
I
don't know. People love Paddington.
Paddington
really
2
good.
Is apparently the greatest movie of all time, so according to Nicolas Cage and his drugged out friend Pedro Pascal in the movie. The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent.
Yes, that is true.
Also, I mean, does have an amazing Hugh Grant performance in Paddington 2.
Is it?
Yeah, he does. He does a really good
Hugh
as, like,
back
the,
in this.
As a villain.
Because it's funny, I was about to make the joke of like, well, when do we find out when he enslaves the Oompa Loompas? And
then they show what was clearly the first ever meeting with an Oompa Loompa.
Yeah,
it is a pretty funny scene with, who's the actor you just said?
Hugh Grant. It's the only thing in the trailer that really worked for me, honestly, was that bit.
It's very CG-ish, and what it looks to me is like, you know, all those movies that Tim Burton made in like the 2000s?
Yeah.
So the Alice in Wonderland movies and his Wizard of Oz movie and all that stuff, they all kind of look samey and CG.
Yeah.
That's what it looks like. I do think, Nick, they look a little better than that, so I'm not going to quite dismiss it all right. But I guess I haven't been hankering for a Willy Wonka prequel.
No, I don't think I'm hankering for one.
Oh, you're hankering.
You're hankering.
Sure.
You hanker for Chalamet.
I don't know where I fall on Chalamet, because sometimes he really annoys the crap out of me, and other times I've kind of won over by his charm a little bit. Do I think he's a great Wonka? No, but I think he's closer to Wilder than
Johnny Depp,
who was
just weird. Do you think he's trying
to
be a prequel to the Wilder one in particular, or is he trying to be a prequel to yet another?
I think
it feels more in line with that.
They're trying to nod to the Wonka.
The Oompa Loompa did the little flute playing that they play before every song, and then very meta. This is part of what makes me a little nervous, even though it was also funny. He's like, once you hear that, we've already begun the song, or whatever.
Can't
and
stop.
I was like, and so that is, it's kind of a meta reference to the singing.
And I know I saw like Olivia Colman in there.
Yeah.
And the cast is really good. And the director makes. The director, I think what draws me to his stuff is like, it's heartfelt. It's not like, it doesn't feel cheap or anything, so.
But if you were to ask me if the person making a Wonka prequel is going to be heartfelt or not, I would usually tell you no.
I challenge you to watch Paddington. Just watch it.
I watch no bear movies.
Except Cocaine Bear.
I didn't even watch Cocaine Bear.
You should watch it. It's really, really good.
I would consider it. I like the idea of a sweet, like, all-ages movie that's maybe... Is it less anarchic than the average Disney Pixar type movie?
I mean, did you ever read the Paddington books as a kid?
At least a little bit.
I mean, it's got a little bit of chaos, but it's very, like, endearing.
He was a little gentle, nice British bear.
That liked,
Hello, I'm your British bear.
Oi. Oi, Gav.
He's like a bear soccer hooligan.
Come on.
We're going down to the pub and knock back a few.
Voiced
Easy
Vinnie
Paddington.
Jones.
Yeah, Vinnie Jones Paddington 3, that's all I'm saying.
I'm quite knackered.
I'm going down to the pub and get me a pint. And knock over some dustbins.
Get ossed.
Go Arsenal.
Alright.
What trailer's next?
Okay, let's talk about... I think this is arguably the worst trailer we watched, and that is the Twisted Metal trailer.
Man. So we went from the very early days of discussing this a year or two back, where we're like, yes, Twisted Metal is a weird PlayStation 1 game with a larger-than-life, futuristic Road Warrior car
fighting. Video game movies and TV shows have been getting better.
I think we were
kind of... And it had a few people involved who were like, seemed like they could be better than you expect.
Yeah, we're like, well, this, I mean, I could see how it worked, and Anthony Mackie is leading it, and Stephanie Beatrice, who's
Nev
great.
Nev Campbell?
Then you see it, and it looks like this Frankenstein creation.
Man, it looks so bad.
And it's really meant to be, like, kind of, you know... anarchically funny.
Yep.
But as you noted, Randy, really none of the jokes land.
No, none of the jokes landed at all. I think it looks like... It doesn't look cheap.
It's slightly cheap.
Yeah, it looks a little cheap.
What was it? You know how... we talked about this back when... American Gods and stuff like that...
Yeah.
Would look like... Okay, that's better CG than you would have had 10 years ago, 20 years ago, but sometimes did look a little bit like that thing where they're like, well, we're going to just filter everything blue in this episode, and we're going to say he's in the Netherworld. Yeah. You know, it had a little bit of that cheapness to it. And this has a little bit of that, too.
I also can't tell who the showrunner is.
Hmm.
Like, I'm looking at the credits, and there's, like, everybody worked on 2 episodes.
Oh.
Is this the one that begins? So it's in like a dystopian future. It has walled cities and stuff like that.
Oh, there are walled cities. Yeah.
Is he a courier person?
Yeah.
Everybody's couriers in these things.
Yeah. It's basically the poor man's Death Stranding.
Yeah, that's possible. If I don't see a person just hiking for hours on end, getting really powerful calves, then it's not a future I want to live in.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody here is hyped for it. It did. The one thing that struck me is I actually could see how it actually could be fun, and the sort of the editing on the trailer kind of killed the humor.
That's possible. I mean, here's the thing. Stephanie Beatrice is amazing in Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Yeah.
And I really want her to be good. And I briefly saw, what's the guy? Jason...
Momoa Schwartzman.
No. The wild hair guy. Yeah, I'm talking about. He's also in Brooklyn Nine-Nine.
Right.
He plays.
He's also in The Good Place.
He's in The Good Place.
Yes.
And does a million voices.
Yes.
God, he listens.
Jason
Manzoukas.
Jason Manzoukas. Yes. Manzoukas flashed by a little bit, and I'm like, man, if we get a bit of a Manzoukas and Stephanie Beatrice reunion here, that alone would get me to watch an episode, but it looks...
But if you had told me Mike Schur was making a Twisted Metal...
I'd be there. This is a bunch of randos.
Yeah, and it looks bad.
We will all have to be convinced.
Good things.
Yeah.
I'm also starting to be convinced that Anthony Mackie might not be a great actor.
I think that might be true.
his acting skills lackey?
Yeah.
Anthony Lackey.
All right. Finally,
I'm hungry. I'm going to grab an Anthony Snacky.
Finally, the trailer that was my favorite that we watched was the Ahsoka trailer.
This was really good.
It's solid if you're one of those people who watched Rebels.
I did love Rebels.
Yeah,
and,
Rebels is amazing.
This is a reunion. I was like, Mandalorian.
Who dat? Yep. Although I was happy to see Mary Elizabeth Winstead as Hera. Is that who she is?
Yeah. She's one of the best pilots in the Rebellion. She's a cool character.
Yep. Were they flying around that prototype A-Wing or something that was...
No, I think they're flying the Ghost, aren't they?
I saw something that was an A-Wing.
But she...
B-Wing.
Yes. She does have the prototype.
Yeah, she was the first pilot.
I remember that was like B-Wing, a big thing on the show from what y'all told me.
But it also looks like they're going to do Sabine as like Ahsoka's Padawan in some regard, which is a neat idea. We also get a little bit more of an understanding of who the villains are, because they...
Evil Obi-Wan Kenobi, as Dave called him.
Yep. He's very tall, if I'm not mistaken.
Ray Stevenson, who passed away.
Last role, maybe?
I think it was. Yeah. But it doesn't look like they're Sith, either.
No, they're Inquisitors.
It does not look... Because they've orange... That was a different person.
Oh, okay.
They have orange lightsabers, which is something we haven't seen before.
Oh.
I mean, we've seen it once.
To me, like, sometimes the, you know, and sometimes this is just what Star Wars is I'm like, well, these are rearrangements of pieces I've seen a billion times.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah.
But, like, it looked like a good arrangement. Ahsoka is cool.
The action
looked
cool.
That she represents somebody who kind of did what Anakin kind of wasn't strong enough to do, which is she left the Jedi.
Yep.
Yeah, she chose... They asked her to come back. She chose not to.
She said, fuck y'all.
Pretty much. That's exactly... Because you didn't believe in me?
Space
fuck
off. So future-y. George Lucas has really been working on creating his own dialect.
Here is my hope, and I hope I'm not getting my hopes too high, is that Filoni... only partially worked on the last season of Mandalorian.
Yeah.
He was too busy working on Ahsoka to have much involvement in that. He came back for, like, an episode or two. And Filoni's great at what he does.
Mm-hmm.
He's shown that through every iteration of animated series he's made.
Yep.
I have faith in the man. this looks really freaking good.
Yep.
I am very excited that to see Rosario Dawson as Ahsoka in a longer format show.
I'm excited to see all the Rebel stuff in live action. I think that's going to be cool. And also, I've liked all the Star Wars shows, except for Andor.
So I enjoy that people are all into Chopper.
Chopper's amazing.
A little manic droid. What's his deal? Tell me what his deal is.
He's crazy.
He's crazy. He murders stormtroopers.
That's cool.
He's Hera's droid.
Finally a non-timid droid. R2 and C-3PO are both some stripe of kind of cowardly.
R2
is not a coward. He's been surly sailor man.
There were plenty of times, though, when R2 was like, you know, when they're on Dagobah, he's like...
is him being stupid and jumping in the water.
Sometimes R2 runs. That's all I'm saying.
There's a meme going around that shows Chopper that is like, this machine kills fascists.
Yeah. Yeah, it's yes. Great.
And, it's... It's going to be fun. And
we don't have that long.
We officially got Ezra confirmed.
Yep.
I mean, we saw him before, but he has lines.
An ultimate reunion of the Rebels characters.
Now, will we get Zeb?
We got
they
Zeb.
They did Zeb in live action on Mandalorian, just briefly.
Sure that they just wanted to make up that really elaborate model one time and use it and then dump it.
It was really good looking.
Yeah.
I assume we'll get some version.
Yeah. That'd be great. Yeah, just a...
How long is this after the events of Rebels?
It's during the Mandalorian Season 3, right?
Yes. Is that like 10 Ahsoka's... years, 20 years?
It must be 10 years.
Because Ahsoka's had to have had time to kind of grow up, but she had already grown up some then.
Maybe it's 20.
She'd grown up. She was like an adult in Rebels.
She was a young adult.
So, wait, Mandalorian takes place after Return of the Jedi, but she was running around as, like, what, a teenager in the Clone Wars.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, I don't know. I think there is, like, a span
of, like...
But also,
she's an alien. She might age differently.
Yeah, they don't care about that stuff on Star Wars. Basically, everybody's a human.
Yeah.
I think it is 20-ish years.
Also, we get our... We got our first official look at Thrawn.
Thrawn looks good.
It looks great. And he's a blue person. That's okay.
Yep.
He's a Chiss.
they did remember to make him blue. Good job, y'all.
Yep. He's blue. Good job.
And it's the same voice who voiced him on Rebels.
Yeah.
It's the same actor. Yeah. So I love that.
It's been a continuity. It is a little weird, you know, when, like, say, you know, Ahsoka definitely is not the same actress who voiced her.
No.
But it's kind of... And because she was basically playing a young character, I'm sure they got a actress with a kind of higher voice. And probably they wanted to show someone who had... whose voice had matured. And so Rosario's a good person for that. Also, a good star. You know, she's a star person. Yes, I'm going to watch this, but I am not particularly hyped for it.
Well, you should watch all, 100
all
episodes
of Rebels
before?
I'll knock that out.
Yeah. 3 or 4 seasons?
Easy enough, how hard could it be? all right. Bits of news. There's going to be a Chronicles of Narnia, at least a couple movies on Netflix. Is Greta Gerwig directing or she's producing?
I've heard directing.
She's coming up Barbie to do Chronicles of Narnia.
That's an odd series of choices.
It is.
Unless you grew up with Narnia. I mean, that is kind of indicative of, like...
I don't have particular interest in seeing another Narnia movie, but if Greta Gerwig makes it, I'll watch it.
Did Disney do 2 or 3 Narnias?
3.
Did they do 3?
And 2 of them are completely forgettable, because who remembers them? The first one was really the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Yeah. It was, like, exceptionally good, I thought.
Santa brings them weapons.
And that is, I am not a fan of necessarily the very highly religious parables.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I'll say this. C.S. Lewis was a storyteller, too.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He spun a great story, and that is a very good adaptation of it. I'm curious to do, because like if they make a few movies, now they may be jumping around a little bit more in time among the, I believe, 5 novels, maybe 6 that they did.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you... I'm just like, is she going to make the same 3 that have been made? It's pretty hard to not begin with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Right.
And that was really done very well. I'm like, what do you bring to the table that wasn't there before? Do you
maybe, yeah, I don't know.
Maybe they'll do like All-Star Superman. It'll be 3 panels. It'll be Lion, Witch, Wardrobe. The story.
Yes.
I mean, she obviously had a story that she
or maybe
pitched.
It will be one of those things. Maybe it almost could be something like that, where it's like, yes, that story is now in the pop, you know, pop cultural knowledge, and so you begin with the follow up stuff.
It's possible.
Anyway, at least kind of interesting. There.
Yeah. 2 bits of news coming out about Deadpool 3. One is that Jennifer Garner is going to return as Elektra.
Yes,
which is weird because while in many cases I'll be like, oh. It wasn't the actor's fault. That was good casting. It was just bad writing. Jennifer Garner's a terrible Elektra. I like Jennifer Garner. She's a terrible casting for Elektra.
But I also think, like, the Daredevil movie and the Elektra movie that followed it especially were not particularly well done.
No.
Like, she wouldn't have had anything to work with. But also, yes, I wouldn't have cast her. But for
Gal
Deadpool...
Gal Gadot is Elektra. Could be, right. Maybe it could be Elektra.
For Deadpool, though, I think it's a fun thing to do.
Sure.
And it's going to be like a 5-minute gag or something.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, sure.
I think that I think it would be like if Deadpool's like, well, I don't know, what's the worst Marvel movie? Wolverine. What's the one that had Deadpool in it?
Yeah,
he's like he'd be like that, or is it Elektra?
Yeah.
And then like Elektra comes out and stabs his ass or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm like, you can have some fun with it.
Yeah.
And I respect them, and Jennifer Garner, I suppose, too, for playing a character that was not exactly beloved on Arrival.
I mean, it does seem like it's going to be probably multiversal type stuff.
Yeah,
they've talked about
now,
that.
Now, can you get Ben Affleck to come back as Daredevil?
I don't know.
I'm betting not, although that would be a pretty good thing to keep hidden.
If you could pull it off.
It'd be fun.
But the other big thing we saw, which the internet is torn in half over, is that we saw Wolverine in his yellow costume.
I didn't click on any of
the comments. Oh, are they torn? I've seen only positive.
Yeah.
People are mad because it turns out Hugh Jackman isn't short.
Really? They're just realizing this?
The picture of them together, you can see they're the same height, and people are mad about that.
That's ridiculous. Those people are stupid.
What, are they going to just use Lord of the Rings technology and make Hugh Jackman tiny?
Literally, I think some people wanted them to do that.
Well, you know what? Here's the thing is, I was trying to figure out if that was an official release shot, or if that was just like a really pretty good snapshot of something from the set.
I don't know.
Also, they've been on camera together before in Wolverine Origins. They're the same height.
Yes, but Nick, they don't want Wolverine to be tall.
That ship sailed in the year 2000.
Yep. Yeah. Yes, it did.
Like,
yes, it did.
I'm like, wait
remember
a minute.
2 decades plus 3 years
yes.
ago?
No. Understand it. I'm not advocating for it. I just think it's hilarious.
Yeah,
they're focusing on that instead of Wolverine in an actual costume.
Right.
Yeah, that, and also, so, I've seen a couple of people who are like, why does he have long sleeves? Okay. That's
because he had long sleeves in 2000.
Yes.
He had, like, the leather jacket.
So this is the
combination now.
Of the yellow spandex that was the quippy line because they were not ready for kind of somewhat realistic superhero costumes or comic accurate costumes in the 2000s. This one looks very much like John Cassaday's art for Joss Whedon's Astonishing X-Men run.
It looks
run.
Fantastic.
It does.
It looks
good.
It's a little bright. But it is it iconically reads as Wolverine.
Yeah,
I am somewhat curious to people who are not comic nerds what they'll think of it. Are they like
We have already gotten so many good memes out of this picture.
Yes,
and there have not we have not seen a mask.
It is funny to me that I think they want you always want to see Hugh Jackman's face. They're going to cheat that one.
I bet they'll do the mask though. Has he ever worn a mask?
No.
You know what? I bet they will do that at some point.
I bet they will.
And if you were going to make some meta jokes, it would be like...
Deadpool would be like, you look
like,
horrible in a mask.
That he'd be like, there are executives passing out. We are paying you so much money right now. And like, you could be anyone in there. You could be a stunt double. You could be my friend Mario.
And then one last little bit of news here. The Schumacher cut.
Yes. So a couple, a year or two back, I don't remember how I got pointed to it, but I sometimes watch video essays on YouTube, and I watched what I thought was really a quite great video essay that's about an hour long, even though I think its thesis is kind of insane. he thinks that there's a guy who's like I don't know, film student, and thinks that Batman Forever, specifically Batman Forever, is a sort of misunderstood masterpiece. Now, when you listen to the full thing, you'll actually hear him saying that, like, there was a lot of stuff left out on the cutting room floor. There's a known, you can read the script and see what was going to be in it. And there was, like, a darker, more serious underpinning to Batman's character arc and a few of the other arcs. And he's like, would it really necessarily play out the way I've imagined it might? And he's kind of quick to acknowledge, he's like, maybe not. So he's like, masterpiece, maybe. But it's super well done, just incredibly well edited, and I would say interesting to watch, even if you think it's just the most insane idea you've ever heard. Now, cut to the present. The cut seems to be kind of existing as a work print. Kevin Smith somehow got a hold of it, and he's been showing it to people, seemingly to kind of drum up interest in, like, you know, this getting the Snyder cut treatment. Yeah. There needs to be some money behind it, there needs to be some edits, music. It has to be worked on. I don't even know if the composer is alive, if they needed some more music. Elliot Goldenthal, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But yes.
You're much better at remembering all that.
There's a... There exists a cut of this. And apparently Kevin Smith believes in it. Kevin Smith also believed in the Star Wars prequels when they were coming out, and lots of other...
He's also a big fan of the Nicolas Cage Superman, I believe.
Yeah. Kevin Smith is a big hype man.
He's a big hype man.
He loves things.
Yeah, I think he just loves things, and that's okay.
Well, one of the reasons I like listening to his interview show was because he kind of had an enthusiastic voice almost no matter what.
Right.
And I can respect that. But I also kind of sometimes like the batshittery of pop culture, and I want to see this weird-ass cut that has some serious elements in it.
It sounds interesting.
I would say if people should look up this video and check it out. It's called, just type in Batman Forever, Misunderstood Masterpiece, maybe YouTube in there, and you'll find the right one.
I watched a couple minutes of it.
And you thought it was pretty well done.
It's interesting.
But you hadn't gotten to, like, what I think are... I think you really do actually have to see kind of the whole thing, or, like, kind of an extended thing, to really see kind of how well edited and how good the thesis is.
And I'm a bad friend. You sent it to me, and I was going to watch it, and then, you know, life.
That's fine. There's no giant hurry or anything. But I legitimately... the thing I compared it to when I sent it to you, Nick, was... the Red Letter Media Plinkett videos, if anybody ever saw those, which were kind of his very harsh critiques, but very well-thought critiques of the Star Wars prequels.
Very funny.
And very funny. And I feel like this works on a similar level. Like, you can just watch this as entertainment and just enjoy the... It's going to be like a really fun, persuasive documentary. So I do recommend people watch that if nothing else, and maybe in a year or two we will finally see the greatness that is the Joel Schumacher cut of Batman Forever.
Maybe, but if I were a betting man...
I bet it's going to happen.
Joel Schumacher is...
He died.
Yeah, he died, right?
I don't disagree that it might happen.
Yep.
It's the greatness I dispute.
Oh, yeah, so that was in quotes.
All right.
He'll always have Lost Boys.
Let's take a break. And then we're going to come back and talk about a movie and a TV show. All right, so Nick and I saw Indiana Jones: The Dial of Destiny.
Correct,
and
we did.
We're going to spoil that.
Yes.
Would you say it's the most exciting movie to ever feature the word "dial" in the title?
That's possible.
That is possible, but I don't. I can't confirm.
Dial in for murder.
Oh yeah. No. That's definitely
sorry.
That's
there's
definitely,
one big one.
That's definitely that's better.
This is the second most exciting dial movie.
if there is even exists a third, please send us an email and remind us.
So. I was skeptical of this. I've been hearing mixed reviews and that kind of thing.
Yep.
I hate Crystal Skull. I've seen it once when we saw it in the theater. I've never seen it again.
Yep.
And I was like, I don't know. But Harrison Ford, older Harrison Ford, has been great on Shrinking.
Uh-huh.
The trailers look good. I like Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yep.
So I decided to go, and I heard there was some cameo stuff, and I'm like, well, I want to see this rather than have it spoiled for me, so I went and saw it.
Yeah.
And now we're going to spoil it for everyone if you haven't seen it. But I think, Nick, you and I both liked it.
Yeah, I think ultimately I did enjoy it.
We both might even rank it third in our Indiana Jones, although we disagree about what is fourth. But we don't disagree about what's fifth.
No. Would third be like mean that it's fighting it out with Temple of Doom?
Or, in my case, Last Crusade.
Oh, interesting. Mm. You know, I'm not the biggest Last Crusade fan, but...
I go Raiders, Last Crusade, Temple of Doom, Dial of Destiny, and then...
I think I go Raiders, Temple of Doom, Last Crusade, and Dial, but Dial is, there's bits of stuff, Dial, stuff I like in Dial I like better than stuff in Crusade.
Crusade just, I think, hit home when I saw it in theaters. Yeah. It just made that impact.
It was a huge crowd pleaser.
It was also actually, I love Sean Connery.
The crowd pleaser stuff is actually some of the stuff I like, I don't like about it, because like, I think it's a little kind of hokey at times. Like, do, you know, I mentioned this before when we were talking off mic the other day. I hate that they kind of turn Sala and Brody into sort of jokes.
They did.
But it's crowd-pleaser jokes. Yeah. It's not dissimilar to the why people love Star Trek IV, which sometimes pokes some fun at those characters and does some irreverent stuff with them. So I don't think it's terrible or anything.
Last Crusade has a great opener.
Last Crusade has a bunch of great scenes
Last Crusade,
in it.
Okay. My issue with the opener is that everything that shaped Indy's life 30 years later all happened to him on one day.
It was like Smallville in one day.
Yeah.
One episode.
So I have a problem with that. I loved it when I saw it in the theater, but every time I've seen it since, I like it a little less.
Did you realize that the guy, the head of the thugs, is Marion's dad? That was the implication that Spielberg wanted to have.
I didn't catch that.
But it's not formally.
It's not formally done, but that's what he wanted, which actually kind of works a little bit.
I didn't get that at all, no.
No, I mean...
The guy who gives him the hat?
Yeah.
I don't get that at
all. That's Ravenwood.
I feel like Marion was supposed to be, or like Ravenwood was supposed to be more of a serious dude.
Yeah, I thought he was like an academic more. I don't buy that. I don't buy it.
If
that was his implication, he failed. That was a bad idea.
I mean, it was Lucas. I was like, didn't Lucas also want like Marion to be
like
13 when Indiana Jones was 20?
Yeah.
And I'm like, whoa, bro.
Yeah.
But getting back to our rankings.
Last Crusade also has, by the way, the no ticket moment, which cracks me up.
Yep.
I really like Sean Connery in it.
A lot of great action scenes. The scenes with the motorcycle chase is good.
Yeah.
I like most of the stuff, I think, on the tank chase. There's a little bit of goofiness.
Which is why, overall, I would say Last Crusade is probably, for me, sits above Dial of Destiny. However, Dial of Destiny is closer than I ever thought it would be, because as an Indiana Jones, as a final Indiana Jones movie, this is a good movie.
Yeah.
It opens with a... during the war, de-aged indie thing.
Mm-hmm.
I know some people found that CGI distracting.
Somebody sitting at this table found it very distracting.
or less distracting than CG Tarkin in Rogue One.
Not that bad.
It's not that bad, but it's not that good either.
Really?
Because I do think that there's like some stuff that like we would probably all agree that Samuel Jackson and Captain Marvel,
that's
pretty
really
flawless.
Good.
Yeah. He looks a little rubbery at times.
I never noticed that.
Oh man, there were a couple moments that just really took me out of it. And
so
I was like,
my big issue with the opening, which is really good. It's like a 20-minute sequence, I think. Feels like 20 minutes.
It's I think 15, but
but it's like he's trying to find the half of Dial of the Archimedes. He meets Mad Mikkelsen's Nazi
character. He's not,
character.
Though. He's after
he's after the spear, which
of
turns
Longinus.
Out not to be there. Yeah.
Yes. Wasn't there.
But he's meeting Phoebe Waller's father, who will be important later.
Played by
Toby Jones.
Yep.
And basically he's on this train full of Nazis as the tail end of the war, as they're trying to sneak artifacts on this train out of Germany.
Yep.
It takes too long. He keeps running into cars full of Nazis, and I'm like, okay, I got the gag. You could shrink this whole thing down a bit.
Yep.
But once they get past that and we're into old man Indy, I got a lot more interested.
Yeah.
Which I think for some people that was like, they don't want an old man Indy. But for me, I want old man Indy.
Well, Harrison Ford's old.
Yeah, he's old.
And they kind of lean into it. He is on kind of the verge of retirement.
Yep.
Not
just verge, he retired.
He's at a retirement party. It's his last day. His life is basically in shambles because Marion's left him.
Marion's left him because Mutt died in Vietnam.
Yep.
That is such a weird collection of words. Now, you know, one of the things I kind of don't like about any of these movies that, you know, follow up on a classic thing 20, 30, 40 years later or whatever, Star Wars,
right.
Star Trek, any
right.
of those things, sometimes if you can't get all the actors and they have to come up with a reason why they're not there, I don't always like those things. So I'm like, oh, you know, I don't necessarily need for Marion and Indy to have been a couple for the ages. I didn't even need them to get married or anything like that.
Well, no, spoiler.
You need them to be broken up for this movie for the movie to work.
Okay.
And the way they I wasn't sure about this either, Dave, because it sounded like maybe they just didn't get Karen Allen. But it wasn't that. It was a story decision.
Okay.
Killing off Mutt was also a story decision. It's a good one because we don't need Shia LaBeouf. But they go into it and they treat it. A lot of people were making jokes about how they, you know, they basically poochied Mutt. They're like, they just sent him on.
Died on his way to his own planet.
But, in fact, it is a major, like, it broke Indy to some extent.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, I've heard people complain that, like, I don't want to see my heroes that they grew up, got old, and their life is sad. And I'm like, you know, that part of getting old is feeling melancholy about your past, and maybe, you know, you didn't achieve everything you wanted to achieve, that kind of thing. So, he's not like sad.
No,
he's just kind of like he's had his life. He's had his career. He's not adventuring anymore, and he kind of like
he's
lives
resigned.
Alone. He lives alone in his apartment. Yeah, he's his life didn't work out the way he wanted to, but he's not like what a tragic life he has.
Well, even in the Star Wars movies where Han and Leia had split up and their kid had become an evil man.
Yeah.
They generally weren't portrayed too morosely.
Yeah,
you know, Han and Chewie were living a little bit by the seat of their pants, but it was kind of still looked like. Oh, they were probably having a fun bro lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because the truth is, if you're going to go back and do these stories, you can't have them living a happy life, because then you can't just, like, do you want to pull them out of their happy life to tell one last story? You want to tell them one last
But that
adventure.
Is one of those things that I kind of don't like as a convention, is the forcing the adventure on them and not letting somebody have a little bit of peace and happy.
So, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, who is his goddaughter, comes to him, and she is basically wanting a thing that she knows he has, which is the half of the dial that her dad was obsessed with. And
she's kind of mean.
She is actually like a tomb robber type. She is, she is selling items at auction to the highest bidder.
Yep.
And you know, given that he was just stealing things to put in the British Museum, he's not much better. And I think they make that reference.
Yeah,
at one
they
point.
Do.
But Phoebe Waller-Bridge is super charming in this.
She is.
Like,
she's
loved
really
her,
good.
And she is the youthful energy. But and he doesn't get pushed all the way to the side.
Nope.
He's definitely a big part of it. And he is faced with in the 60s, after the astronauts have gone to the moon, that kind of thing, a guy who was a Nazi scientist who helped get the rockets to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
So the astronaut stuff is a big thing. Because
Is it Wernher von Braun?
He's essentially a stand-in for.
Yeah.
Mads Mikkelsen is one of the guys who came in through
Operation... Wernher von Kraut.
He came in through Operation Paperclip.
Yep.
But he is obsessed with this dial, and... The reason he wants... He's got... was it Boyd Holbrook playing his psycho American Nazi guy?
Yep.
Who very believable and very good. And then a big, giant, beefy Nazi guy.
Yep.
But they're like... He's got a CIA protector with him who is basically, like, trying to get him this thing because, like, the president wants to keep you happy because you helped make the rocket, but now you're doing all this crazy Nazi shit.
Correct. Yeah, I thought Mads Mikkelsen was great. This is directed by James Mangold, so Boyd Holbrook has to be there
because
they are attached at the hip, pretty much.
All right, didn't know that.
Boyd Holbrook is actually really good in this. He's very creepy.
The story of where it goes. One of the things I loved about this is that the trailer does not give everything away.
No.
In fact, the trailer really only shows the first half of the movie because it showed. The horse chase in New York City during the parade and in the subway, and it's super fun. There's some really good action sequences.
That's some good ones.
But like all the overseas stuff, I don't even know if we saw any of that in the trailer. And that Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character has her own short round,
right?
And that kind of works. And Mikkelsen's sort of his ultimate plot and what they get up to. The guest star who is like Indy's old buddy,
yeah.
The diving thing was really fun, like 1960s diving.
Right?
Yeah, it's Antonio Banderas.
It's Antonio Banderas. And
he plays an old Spaniard who has a fishing boat in Greece.
Okay.
And they use him to go...
One of those, you know, the equivalent of Brody or Sala or one of his allies.
And by the way, Sala in this is fantastic.
Yeah, he's good.
I got good vibes from the trailer from him. There was something about him that told me this didn't quite seem like too goofy like the third
one. Well, I mean, he's kind of what you described. He has his happy ending.
He had his happy ending.
He has his family.
With his family
in America.
Yeah, basically, Indy, during the tail end of the war, Indy got him to America with his kids.
Uh-huh.
And so that's where... So he's like his old buddy.
Right.
But Saul is like, I want to go with you.
Saul wants to go on last adventure, and then he tells him no.
And he's like, no.
And he's like, you've had your adventures. You stay here with the kids. And it's pretty cool.
Does John Williams do the music?
Yes. The music is great every time. It always works. There is, Dave, as you suspected, time travel.
Hold on.
I thought it was a lesser outing for John Williams. Really? Yeah. Because it was basically hitting all the same notes.
I mean, there's only so much you can do.
I know, but Williams is a great composer.
Well, like there was like some, you know that in Temple of Doom, there was that something that's like, there were some other themes that were not just the classic one.
Yeah.
This one, I didn't... They weren't as impactful as like other Indiana Jones movies were.
He's not quite at A game. Like let's be truthful. He's incredibly skilled, but that was also in evidence in the Star Wars sequel trilogy.
Dude's in his 80s now.
Yeah, no, I know. No,
he's 100 billion.
I'm just that was something I noticed while watching.
I didn't notice it. I just basically know that the music themes always work.
Yeah,
you know the famous indie scene. Dave, you had suspected there might be some time travel involved in all this.
Right, I wasn't sure if that when we saw the younger Indy, whether he was like, I don't know, somehow reliving something or that traveling back.
That is actually just the past,
but there is time travel.
And the time travel works so well.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure about it. I thought it might be like, this might be like Aliens in the third act, and I'm like, is this going
to
ruin this entire
movie?
Does
he time travel to dinosaur times?
No, but he does time travel back a ways.
Okay.
The Nazi's trying to get back to, he wants to basically go and kill Hitler before he invades Poland, so that he can basically... He knows all Hitler's mistakes, and he wants to make the Third Reich...
He wants to do it right. The leader of the Nazis.
And there's some miscalculations, and they do not wind up in Nazi times.
That, I honestly think, was the best swerve.
What a great twist.
Fantastic.
I might need to catch this in theaters, because... It's just one of those things that occurs to me. Like, so, first of all, Raiders of the Lost Ark cast a long shadow over my life. When I was a kid, it was the first movie that I was aware of that was, like, a really ingenious action movie that seemed to work on all elements.
Yeah.
But, like, my brother and probably my dad would tell me a little bit about the filmmaking and the editing and, oh, look at this interesting camera shot through the whirling fan and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I kind of became aware of cinematography from that movie.
Yeah.
I guess I've seen, for better or worse, with the Crystal Skull, all of these in the theater. It might feel a little weird if I don't catch it in the theater.
You should see this in the theater. I think it works on the big screen. I'm not going to spoil the ending, because
I will say there is no CGI gopher in the first five
minutes.
There's
no CGI gopher.
Okay.
So, actually...
I think this really worked for me, and the ending was actually very strong for me.
Yeah, I agree.
Need a photoreal CG mutt with the gopher ally.
Yes.
And the giant fire ants that carry you
into
the mound.
And he's swinging on a vine?
And he's swinging on a vine into a refrigerator.
He throws the gopher just like Minsk throws Boo.
It is less egregious. It's entirely less egregious than Crystal Skull.
In fact, the funny stuff in it.
That's what I'm saying. The one thing for me that doesn't work, it's not very funny.
Yeah.
I think I heard that.
Like, I did not find a lot of wit in it. In fact, not even like the barbs between like Indy and his goddaughter. Like, there's not a lot of, like, funny bits. Mangold seems to have toned that down to the point of being maybe too far.
Yeah.
Like, I want a little wackiness in my Indy Jones, and there was nothing. I mean,
there was a little
bit...
call
Dr. Jones doll.
A little bit of wackiness on the tuk-tuk. Is it... Are they called the tuk-tuk? Yeah, there was a little wackiness there.
But it's very restrained by Indiana Jones standards.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's good or bad. It works for me. But I would have liked it to be a little lighter, a little more fun. I think that is where Last Crusade has the edge for me, is that it's fun.
Not super wackiness in Raiders.
Raiders has some funny bits. The Nazis,
moments.
There's some slapstick in the last chase
dates
with the Nazis. Bad dates.
Also, there's a lot of sort of visual humor in the opening thing in the temple with Alfred Molina.
Yeah.
Just how terrified he is. There's visual humor when Indiana Jones has one or two tarantulas on it. He turns Alfred Molina around. Yep. He's got like 30 tarantulas on him.
There's also the bit where he and Mariner in the ship, and she's like
she mirror smacks
hits him with the mirror.
Yeah. That was slapstick. You're right.
It's kind of cleverly done. They sort of managed to have it so that Indiana Jones is kind of a lot of the humor is kind of around him. He takes his licks a lot, and he sometimes fails. And you know, makes it. He misjudges things sometimes. Yeah. He's a guy who will leap, like swing badly and hit a cliff.
Yeah,
I think my ultimate criticism, and for better or worse, I think Mangold filed the Spielberg off of it a little bit too much.
Yeah,
and I think that's where it falls apart. But yeah. I still enjoyed the movie.
This works a lot better than I expected to.
Yeah,
I'm very pleased with it. I'm glad I saw it. I'm glad I didn't listen to the naysayers, and then I went and saw it in the theater.
Yeah.
And I recommend, Dave, that you should go see it at the theater.
Duly noted.
All right. The other thing we're going to talk about is My Adventures with Superman, which, Dave, I know you've only seen like 10 minutes of.
Yep, but enough to get the... I got the vibe.
Got the gist.
Yeah. And I like the look of it. I am going to watch it. I like Superman, and it seemed fun. There's like a year one Superman kind of thing. Not year one, like in Smallville, but year one in Metropolis with a bit of a... kind of a youthful anime-ish... style to it.
Yeah, so it also flashes back to him as a child in Smallville.
That's true. I actually like found that opening very heartwarming.
Yeah.
So the basic thrust of this is that Clark and Lois and Jimmy are all interns of the Daily Planet.
Yep.
Lois has been an intern there for longer, so she knows. So Perry knows her enough to be annoyed by her.
Yep.
Because she is supposed to stay there and make coffee and do all the interny things.
That is not what Lois
She is running out doing very dangerous investigative journalism.
Because Lois is a reporter.
And on day one, she drags Clark and Jimmy, who are buddies and roommates,
yep,
in together to do this. And Clark has not become Superman yet.
Nope.
He becomes Superman in this first episode.
Okay. But he is kind of wrestling with his powers and his abilities, yep, and he likes to destroy... not likes, but he destroys clocks, alarm clocks.
Yeah, occasionally he does not know his own strength and destroys
clocks. I love the line from Jimmy's like, why do our alarm clocks keep exploding?
Yeah. So they're roommates?
They're roommates. They're all contemporaries, which I think makes it interesting. Because Jimmy has technically usually been like the kid reporter, but these are all... they're all right. Like, you know, young 20-something... reporters.
Usually, even though Jimmy's younger than Clark, they are buddies, and there's no particular reason why you can't sort of tighten that age gap for another story about Superman.
It definitely works. They also did some interesting thing with Jor-El, where Jor-El is looking like he looks like a weathered...
Odin?
Odin, yeah. and he's speaking Kryptonian, which Clark doesn't understand.
Correct.
And so he's, like, terrified of him at first, and then it's not until the second episode when he goes and...
Goes inside the
Kent farm. There's, like, a Fortress of Solitude on
the
Kent farm, essentially.
Yeah, pretty much.
And discovers who he is and gets his Superman manga transformation.
Yeah, there's some rethinks,
You know who the girl is, right? The villain? It's Livewire.
Oh, that's what I thought.
She's like a mercenary, but she's using, like, all this alien tech...
That's a big rethink for Livewire.
It is. Yeah. She's a merc, and
there's kind of rethinks all throughout a little bit, and I actually think they're all really good.
Yeah. Well, they reveal that she's working with like Waller and those guys. Yep. So.
What's weird about that though is I actually did always like that Livewire was like a civilian type person.
Sure.
You know? She was famously a shock jock.
Yep.
Shock jock.
Yeah. You get it. You see why they changed it?
No, that's good. But. Shock Jocks, obviously Howard Stern is going to always exist. He's got mega popularity.
Yeah.
But it's kind of not the breakout pop cultural thing it was
right.
in the 90s.
Exactly.
So I guess I can see changing that. And what are you going to do? Have a political commentator? Have her be one of the Fox's bimbo sort of...
She's a podcaster.
That would make some sense. If she was like a an overzealous crime podcaster.
But also,
I don't know.
Livewire was introduced as someone who was like she didn't believe in the Superman hype.
Right.
There hasn't been any Superman hype at this point. He is new hero.
Yep.
So introducing her here... Basically, they just want to give him another villain, I think. So,
Does she have the powers in this?
No, she's using alien tech. Yeah,
but they've essentially made Livewire his first villain.
His first villain, yeah,
which is kind of cool.
That's good. I think it's good to start with people who aren't Brainiac and Luthor and stuff like that, and especially with Superman. I do think it's worth taking some of those characters and. There's even Deanie and Tim didn't necessarily come up with definitive versions.
No.
I like their take on, say, Parasite.
Yeah.
But, it wasn't quite one for the ages the way Clayface or Mr. Freeze was. So
right.
I am a little more open to seeing it. Let's see another take on it. Let's let some of these sort of lesser known characters shine with a rethink.
I enjoyed their Toy Man.
I've never liked a Toy Man in anything.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you there. You're talking about the 90s one?
Yeah.
But I do remember his, like, bouncing ball.
He's creepy enough.
That, like, every time it bounced, it, like, doubled its speed, and so then it's, like, going through, like, steel and stuff like
that.
But
he's, like, a little, he's like a little creepy doll man, and it doesn't make any sense.
He is. He is, like, oh, he looks like a little jigsaw or something like that.
But they never explain why he was a little doll man.
I thought they did.
Did they?
I don't know.
I don't remember. Anyway.
It's the 90s. I don't remember that.
It's interesting because...
what, he's an evil doll man. What? What do you want from
Adventures
me?
Superman, evil man. My Adventures of Superman really works for me.
Yeah.
But it is very different from the Superman that's gone before. Like, they don't... like, the first Superman spent... like, it opened with Brainiac and Krypton and all that stuff. Right. And then when we saw Superman, he was Superman. This is younger... This is
unsure Superman.
Yeah.
It's not unlike Smallville in some respects.
But he's Superman in this. And it's not all about high school.
Correct.
And there isn't a bunch of meteor kids.
But I feel like
it's good.
They do a good job of portraying Clark and Superman.
Yeah.
And Clark feels like Clark. I mean, regardless.
Is Clark having to do does he kind of do the act yet?
He's basically just figuring it out in this first one.
Yes.
Okay. So Clark is
I'll be
Clark.
Curious to see how they pull that off because although I love the Christopher Reeve, at least like say the first two movies, actually kind of don't like the idea of the guy who's kind of always having to pull the wool over the eyes of his friends, always kind of lying to his best people, and who you know for their safety pretends to be a doofus and always disappoints them.
No, when we meet him, he's Clark.
Yeah,
like Clark is not the act.
Right.
When we meet him in this, he is Clark Kent. He is who he's always been. And his clumsiness, any clumsiness is like destroying alarm clocks and that kind of thing.
Right. It's related to reigning in his powers.
Also, interestingly, Lois is into him. He's a big, tall, good-looking guy.
Right.
And she is into him. And that's kind of fun because that's a reversal of where they usually go.
Their meet cute is actually really good.
It is. It's really good. So they've done some tweaks to make this work. And I think that the Superman thing is going to be interesting, because for him being, like, the confident Superman guy is going to be the hardest thing to pull off, because it doesn't fit with his sort of anxious vibe.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see how they pull that off. But
they dropped the first two episodes.
First two episodes are really, really good.
And then it's on Thursdays?
It's on Thursdays on Max, yes.
Yeah.
On Wednesdays, if you happen to still have adults.
There's a really cool, you know, and I've seen versions of this before, but I thought it was one of the best I'd seen, where you see him do his first flight as a kid.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, that was really, really well done.
Yeah. No, it's a lot of fun. The animation is great. The voices are good. Nick was noting is Jack Quaid, who has now played the lead of The Boys, and also, what was the other thing?
Boimler
on Star Trek.
Yep. Lower Decks, the Star Trek animated thing.
All right. That is it for us this week. We'll be back next week with more. Until that time,
Yo, Joe!
Roguecast is a weekly podcast broadcast from Rogues Gallery Comics and Games in Round Rock, Texas. You can find us online on Facebook and at www.roguesgallerytx.com and email us comments or questions at roguesgallerytx@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.